Today's episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by Shudder. Brought to you by AMC Network, Shudder is not only a premium streaming video service, but an experience unlike any other. Curated for fans of all degrees of thriller, suspense, and horror, Shudder is home to the largest and fastest-growing human-curated selection of high-quality, spine-tingling, and provocative films, TV series, and originals. And there's always something new and unexpected for Shudder members to explore.
Now on Shudder is the cult television series Hammer House of Horror, a collection of terrifying modern-day stories of vengeance from beyond the grave, ghoulish mysteries, limbless bodies bent on murder, timeless tales of undying curses, and each a surefire hair raiser. The Hammer House of Horror made a devastating impact on the world of horror and science fiction. Its eye for devilish detail makes it one of the best horror series ever broadcast on television. Starring Peter Cushing as Master of Horror, the Hammer House of Horror presents us with a vivid picture of real fear. Hold on to your hearts, for this series is bound to make you scream. Shudder is available for $4.99 a month or $49.99 for an annual membership. But our listeners can get a free month by entering the promo code SHOCK at checkout. Go to Shudder.com today and find the best collection of thrillers, suspense, and horror available to stream anywhere.
This episode of Shockwaves is also sponsored by friends at Fright Rags. That's fright-rags.com. Right now, as this episode airs, there are brand new items for John Carpenter's Halloween in stock, which include shirts, socks, pins. There's some really, really cool Halloween stuff, as well as the custom-made orange and black baseball tees with the classic Halloween designs and vintage-styled Halloween decoration-themed designs from Michael Myers, as well as Sam from Trick or Treat. Elric, I don't know, did you ever eat General Mills cereal monsters in New Zealand?
No, but when I was young in America, I remember them.
And you do remember
them. Was something that didn't make it over there. I always thought the design was awesome.
They have cool masks for them right now. I looked at them yesterday. They've got these really cool monster cereal masks and like t-shirts for them as well.
That's cute.
And because it comes out today, as this episode airs, they have exclusive Jigsaw shirts and pins coming. I'm pretty excited. I've been seeing the poster. My favorite, that poster image where it looks like Tobin Bell with like the Billy makeup on the face. I can't tell if it's really him or not, but that poster is striking and wonderful.
Yeah, and I guess we have now that Jigsaw's dead in quote marks, it's like they could go anywhere with the series. This could become a supernatural kind of character in a weird way. Every order during the month of October will contain a faux Fright Rags membership card that is designed to look exactly like a Blockbuster membership card, so a nice throwback there, with a special secret code on the back that's good for 10 to 50% off the next order. Have you had any luck with that?
No.
Okay, well, keep trying. The amount will be revealed when the customer enters the code.
Beautiful.
Also, just drop in, they've got Halloween 3, like little enamel pin of the masks that are absolutely awesome. And I really, really, really need the Trick or Treat socks.
Oh, yes. That's fright-rags.com. Episode number 71 of Shockwaves. I'm one of your hosts, Rob Galuzzo. I'm sitting here with Mr. Elric Kane.
Hey, man. It's been too long.
You know, we had a little fun ribbing going on in your other show.
That's right.
Where you
I wonder if everyone knows that we all know each other or not. If for a new listener, they'll have no idea.
It was pretty fun, I think.
Yeah, that was fun.
Even though it was a nightmare to you have to post that video of everything going wrong.
We thought we lost the whole episode.
Yeah, yeah.
Because your old computer died.
Because my old computer. But that's a whole nother show.
That's a whole nother
show. This one's Shockwaves, which also is co-hosted by Rebecca McKendry.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Welcome back. People were very concerned about you, Becca.
I know. I'll tell what happened as I talk about the movies because it gave us into one of the movies I watched this week. But I had a very exciting
She's going to tie in her ailment into a movie.
I am. My whole world is thematic, guys. It all joins together.
Hit us with it.
Yeah. But anyways, I am back and feeling better and missed you guys dreadfully last week. And I was really bummed that I missed Nancy.
You definitely missed one of the best ones.
Yeah.
I've heard
great guest.
Everyone, great and not just you guys, everyone that I talked to that knew her says that she is just like the most genuinely wonderful, sweet person. And so I'd always wanted to meet her in person to confirm that.
It's what you would hope Nancy would be like in real life. And she really is like the real Nancy.
Aww.
So
yeah,
it's awesome.
Hey, Ryan's here too.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, Ryan's here. I thought you were going to go into a story.
Most
anticlimactic story ever.
I guess we'll get back to that.
I was going to wait till we went to the
movies. So, guys, let me tell you about my terrifying weekend. So,
you're pulling a Becca now.
Oh, wait, is this the big night school story? I was so moved by that on your post.
Hitchcock
didn't come in the
mail.
So,
this is what happened. Guess what happened? So, listeners, you really give a shit about this. No, so yesterday I get an email from Amazon saying, we apologize, but your package has been lost and or destroyed in delivery.
How does it get destroyed, and how do they know that?
And I was like, oh, no, what's in it? You know.
The Blu-ray of Night School and Demon Wind. Yeah. So, actually, I was super fucking stoked to dig into one of these two titles last night. And so what I wound up doing at 11 o'clock at night is talking to, I think her name is Angèle from Amazon.
Did you have to call a help hotline, Ryan?
I was on the chat, the Amazon chat, and I was like, Angèle, listen, I'm not functioning tonight. I need my night school and my demon wind. And she was like, don't worry, Mr. Turek, we're going to look into this for you. And I was like, what happened to the package? She goes, well, it must have been damaged during delivery or it was just lost, but we're going to get two right out for you.
Right. Someone stole your demon wind, Ryan.
And so what was great is I was like, well, Angèle, I'd prefer to have these tomorrow. And she was like, I got that for you.
Done deal.
And guess what?
You got them in a day?
I just got the call and my packages
has arrived.
Up. They've arrived. As did my original package.
Oh! Giveaway. I guess I'm going to inherit
some. I got two copies of Demon Wind.
Actually, I want to watch Night School. I haven't seen that one. Wow.
You know what? What can we do? I'm feeling greedy.
Well, give them to us first, and then we'll give them away.
Don't be greedy.
I was going to say, let's give them away to some listeners on the Facebook page.
You know what, listeners? I want to see... On our Shockwaves podcast Facebook page, I want to see the best old school Halloween costumes from you.
Ooh.
Oh, yeah.
Post an OG Halloween costume, best one.
We'll get your Blu-rays.
Gets a Blu-ray.
Wow.
That's
all
cool. Right?
That's pretty good. And by the way, there was a lot of female Slither defenders.
Yes.
Via the social media.
You know what? I'll open this up to Twitter too. Tweet at us.
Yeah, the photos.
Your photos as well.
Mm-hmm. That's very cool. All righty. Well, obviously we have a lot to talk about. We got some guests. This is our Halloween episode. This is it. We've survived October for the most part. A couple of shout outs right off the top of the show. I just wanted to send a hello to Stacey Rode, who her partner is Dustin Sane, and they're both good friends of ours from Texas. And in
multi
fact,
years of Texas.
For the last several years, they usually bring us, me and Elric, but they bring us booze.
But they take us for barbecue as
they
well.
They do, Dustin has shot a lot of our panels. So a lot of the panels that you see from Texas Frightmare that are up on YouTube are from Dustin and Stacey. And Stacey's been in the hospital for a little while now, but he had told me that she's been listening to the show from the hospital. Aww. And so shout out to both of you. I know he's been listening, going back and forth. And obviously, I think Elric, you commented online saying, because he was saying it feels like friends keep me company on the way to the hospital. And you're like, that's because we are.
We are friends.
And we are.
We are.
So we're thinking of you. Get better soon, Stacey.
Love you guys.
Really appreciate everything you guys have done for us. Another one that blew me away, and I think it might have been Ryan that commented, but it was one of the first comments when we posted the Heather Langenkamp episode. It was on Facebook from Waldo San Miguel, who was writing from Puerto Rico and said that he had no power, but he was going to listen to the show on his phone and he needed it. And again, you know, we're for the most part in our own bubble, like it's the four of us, and we bump into people, friends and stuff. But when you hear, you know, considering the shit that they're going through right now over there. And we hear from somebody saying that they're going to listen to our show. I was kind of blown away by that. And so thank you, Waldo, sending our thoughts to you and everybody else there. Because that it's the fact that you guys are going through what you're going through and listening to our ridiculous ramblings
and
us fanboying out for Heather Langenkamp, that's amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know? Johan in a Swedish prison. Who's listening? Thank you, and it just means the world to us.
Thank you for sending us
the lingerie photos,
skin flakes from behind your ear to Elric Kane. You really appreciate it.
I've been watching too much Mindhunter. It's getting into their heads.
Well, a lot of news as of this airing right now. You can go on Hulu and watch episode 4 of Frights and Insights, which is a 21-minute video episode of Shockwaves.
It is crazy.
This is so much fun. I mean,
you get to look at our ugly mugs.
Yeah. And it's weird. Like, we taped this in the theater here at Blumhouse, and so it looks lovely. But, like, there was a makeup crew that, like, came and put makeup on us.
And we did this shit professionally.
Yeah, and it was awesome. So, yeah,
yeah, basically, yeah, I mean, basically, it's a version of our show where we're recommending stuff that's on Hulu right now. And it was just such a blast to do. And there's something kind of neat about hearing us talk about these movies and then seeing footage of the movies. Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah, that's nice.
I was really impressed by the way it was put together. And from what I understand, they seem to be doing well so far. And the other three were a lot shorter, the like little 5-minute interviews that I did. But please watch it, spread the word, tweet to Hulu, and tag them on Facebook, because we would love to do more, especially the Shockwaves ones.
We would love to keep doing this.
How does Hulu membership work for those who aren't? So if they sign up, do they get any period free just so they can have a tester? Do you know?
I believe you get 30 days free when you first sign up, because I know I did. And that was like a year ago when I joined Hulu. So I want to say that they still have that going.
Yeah, there is definitely a free trial. So if you want to just test the waters and subscribe so you could at least see the Frights and Insights stuff, and including Shockwaves, because I think obviously if you love our show, I think you're going to get a real kick out of it. Mm-hmm. And please rate it, because right now it's hovering at about 3.5 of 5 stars, and that doesn't seem fair. Yes.
Get us
so,
up there.
Come on,
probably
guys,
because Shockwaves hasn't hit yet.
Yeah.
I know.
And then
Shockwaves,
suddenly it's your 6 star. Yeah.
Yes, so give us some good ratings, guys, please.
Yes. And my last plug, because I know Becca's got a very interesting announcement to make. But my last one is, obviously last week we announced that I was heading up to Dread Central Presents with Epic Pictures, and I just want to say that we're all over social media now. So Dread Central Presents is on Instagram, on Facebook, and then on Twitter it's Dread Presents. So hit us up. I've got about 10 titles that I think we're about to announce, maybe by the time this airs, and we'll be releasing them starting in January of 2018. So the ball is rolling, and we've got some cool shit coming out. So please follow us there. Now, Becca, tell us something interesting.
So I had an interesting week a couple of weeks ago. I think that a lot of the females in the industry did, when a lot of the Weinstein news started breaking.
What news?
You haven't heard it yet?
I'm part of the hegemon. What do I hear? You know?
Not the time.
Crack a joke elsewhere. But yeah, when all of that started coming to light, you know, many, I'd say all of the females who work in the industry were all immediately either sharing stories of how we, you know, experience things like that on our own, you know, talking about the whisper system, which is truly a thing. The whisper system, when you're on set and someone just says to you, that guy over there, don't find yourself alone in a room with him. And that's how usually these things happen on set is, you know, it doesn't come to light. It just is more of like a whisper thing that happens amongst females, and sharing this. And, when I was talking with a number of other people in the industry about it, the thing that pissed me off the most is that as much as we have been fighting to get females into the film industry and fighting to see more female directors and especially, you know, more female horror filmmakers, when shit like this happens, it gives us a bad name and makes people not want to come do this for a living. And so I was so enraged, and I literally just looked at Dave one morning and was like, I'm going to make a scholarship. I want to encourage someone to come, and I want it to be a female, and I want to encourage a female to come make horror films. And so I'm going to make a scholarship. And I started calling a few people, and I literally came in that day and told these guys, hey guys, I'm doing a scholarship. Shockwaves. We're going to do this. We're going to promote it, and it's going to happen.
And we said, if you build it, they will come.
And that's exactly.
And an old man-y voice.
And,
is the Theory of Viscera kind of festival anything to do with it? Or?
Yeah. So I ended up, after I came to you guys first and said, hey guys, I'm making a scholarship, I then made my next call to the Etheria Film Festival and said, ladies, let's make a scholarship. And so details are just now emerging, but we're making a scholarship. And
I love when the source of news is saying details are just emerging. But you're the news source.
I know.
When are we going to get the full details?
We're still coming up with the titling and things like that.
Okay, we're a bit down the road, but there's something
down the road. But
really
that's
cool
it.
But just for the record, I put on record that it should be for Darth Wishman, because then it could be Make-A-Wishman Foundation.
I love that.
And that just writes itself.
But that said, I have never been one to like sit around and wait for the paperwork and ink to dry. So next, tomorrow, literally the night that this airs, Friday night, I have a booth at Family Night in Burbank, which if you're in Los Angeles area, the last Friday night of every month in Burbank, they do this massive outdoor event where they set up all these vendors and you get to walk up and down the streets. I have a booth. I will be outside of Blast from the Past. I will be selling horror purses made by my mother. We will be selling all different types of horror home goods, all of those great crafts that I always bring to Texas Frightmare. Nice. I will be selling there, and 100% of the proceeds are going to the scholarship. So if you're in the Los Angeles area, please come out to Family Night at Burbank on Friday and stop by Blast from the Past and say hi.
That's great.
Yeah.
Excellent. You need a name.
I know.
Work on that, because then we can really pump
the dude, name. I created this last week.
Yeah, well,
let me.
Slacker.
I'm on it. I spent a couple days in the hospital of
Becca
that. So.
Project.
So wait a minute. When is this again? When
this is Friday night.
Okay, Friday night.
Yeah, Friday night. So the night this airs.
Got it.
I will be in Burbank.
Cool.
Selling stuff for a scholarship.
Let's do it.
All right. What have we seen? Let's go. Elric,
for it. What haven't we seen? So for one, I was judging the Knoxville Horror Film Festival in Tennessee this weekend, and I love judging these film festivals. One of the main reasons, because the features you often are going to see anyway, but some of these shorts are dynamite. One short that I really pushed to win is one of the best films I've seen this year. It's so up my alley, so crazy. It's basically Carrie Coon, isn't it? The great Carrie Coon from The Leftovers, and it's called Great Choice. And it is so bonkers. Yes. Have you seen it?
I've talked about this.
Oh, you've talked about this?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
On here?
I don't know if I'm here, but I've talked to you guys about it.
I hadn't heard it.
It is my favorite short this year.
I totally agree. I think it's probably somebody who might have worked on some of the sets of her, maybe even The Leftovers. That was the vibe, because if Carrie Coon's in it, she's probably doing a favor. But my God, she's great. It's basically, what is that, Lobster House? Is that the company?
Red Lobster.
Red Lobster. Okay, I just forgot the name of that. Yeah. So it's basically a Red Lobster 80s commercial that you're watching, really cheesy, but it looks authentic with the kind of VHS tracking. And each time it keeps repeating itself. The first time's perfect. Second time there's like a weird awkward pause where he's like, you need all the 21 shrimp. And she looks and goes, I guess. And then the third time it's just like, am I meant to talk here? And it starts deconstructing the commercial. And then it gets to a point where somebody leans into her.
The waiter gets very aggressive.
The waiter's very aggressive. And then a woman's leaning into him going, you know, just say the fucking line. And it gets outrageous and violent. And by the end of it, I was like, this is one of the smartest things. I mean, it trumped even all the features I watched at this festival. I was so into it. So super excited to, you know, get
Robin Komisar, who's a New York filmmaker.
Okay.
He did that.
I saw this at a festival this year, and it's crazy. Yeah. It feels very Adult Swim.
It's
like those ones that they've been playing. Yeah.
Yeah.
But anyway, great movie. Also, a buddy of ours.
Great Choice. That's what it's called.
Great Choice. Yeah.
Great Choice.
Great Choice. And it's really something. And then a buddy of ours. So, you know, we're impartial. Graham Skipper, his film, which I hadn't seen yet. Sequence Break, which is total Extestens world, you know what I mean? Even down to like the GUI controls. But the cool thing is he set it in an arcade game booth. And what I liked about his movie is he took a really serious – it's a really serious movie, even though it's like got the goopy horror fix. And I feel like a lot of people go a little more campy with these movies. It's definitely a riff on movies we've seen from the 80s and 90s for sure, a little bit, especially Cronenberg. But what I like is like Chase is great when he's funny. And this he's super serious in this, and I think he actually is one of his better performances playing, you know, a much more serious character. But it's all about kind of a guy who's fixing arcade games, and he basically he's on this other level as he plays this game, and it kind of pushes to a really trippy, surreal place with the idea of a sequence break being, you know, the point where you're mastering a game, I guess. I just thought it was really interesting, really a fun, innovative film, but it's not like, it's different from some of our friends who have been making films that I'd say like from B. Gus and Jackson's film, which I feel are like paying reference to movies they really love. This one, I feel like he's trying to do something quite serious and weird, offbeat with it. And because Graham's not maybe, I wouldn't say natural filmmaker, because he's coming more from acting, I feel like he did a really good job putting it together. It feels very, like, I don't know, serious. I think you'll find it interesting. I think it might surprise you. It goes very experimental towards the end. There's even like parts of animation where it's like, oh, that's interesting. I just thought it was cool. You know?
Cool. Excellent.
Very
Becca,
cool.
What'd you say?
So I'll start with the one that relates to what was happening. So
let's get the punchline of this story.
The reason that I was out last week, guys, as I think I've mentioned on the show before, I'm allergic to nuts. Insert whatever sophomore joke that I've heard since fourth grade. You went to right there.
Or every episode with Elwood.
Yeah, every episode with Elwood. He usually says them before we go live, but yeah, something nut related.
It's anyway, too easy. I'm blanking.
I've been hearing it since fourth grade, so it's going to take a lot to impress me.
To stop people like me from making jokes like that.
It's really the Stop Kane scholarship. But
hey, that's cool.
Anyway, so I was having a tea during a meeting, and I ordered black tea, and apparently at this particular shop, they decided to put hazelnut flavoring in their black tea. So like half an hour later, I'm in the hospital with like my throat swelling closed. It was a trip. So anyway, I was out having that issue for a while. So I actually watched a lot of television, which I'll talk about in a sec. But I posted up that I'd had an allergic reaction to hazelnuts, and somebody wrote, "Oh my gosh, have you seen the 2003 film Red Riding Hood? It's about a girl who tortures her grandmother with peanut butter, and it's a peanut allergy thing." And I was like, "I've never seen this movie." And so then I was torn between like watching the ailment I had currently just had, where I like tasted death momentarily, versus a horror movie I'd never seen. So it was kind of a rough moral decision there, but I ended up watching the movie because the horror movie love won out. And so 2003 Red Riding Hood, it is an Italian film by Giacomo, and I hope I say this right, Simony, and real small, real low budget. I really liked it. I mean, you could definitely kind of see the strings for a lot of it, but I was shocked by how much I enjoyed it. It's the whole thing is about a 12-year-old protagonist. It's a 12-year-old girl named Rose, and pretty much her entire family are a bunch of dicks. And she gets passed around, and her father dies, and he was kind of the only one that she really connected with. And so then she gets passed around. And she has this puppy that she's been raising since he was a little baby named George. And we see her as like a really young girl, where we see like what assholes her family are. And then it flashes to when she's 12. She's now living with her very strict, very horrible grandmother. And George has morphed into a full-sized adult person in a wolf mask. And George follows her around and helps her kill people. And kind of becomes her backing. Like whenever somebody pisses her off, he kills them.
Okay.
And so it's ultimately kind of functions like a serial killer movie, but you're following the serial killer. And it was interesting because it was a 12-year-old girl was the protagonist, and you don't see that a lot. And I mean, it was very low budget, but there was something really fascinating about it. And the allergy part wasn't portrayed very realistically, so I was able to get through that pretty well.
But this is Italian?
It's Italian, okay. But it was in English. The version I saw, I rented it off, I want to say Amazon. And the version I saw was in English. But yeah, it was a fascinating movie. It's B, but and then I looked and like all of the IMDb reviews were like, really fascinating movie, very low budget, really fascinating though. If you haven't checked out 2003's Red Riding Hood, really good wolf mask. Like the mask is actually quite fast, really stark and spooky.
Can we talk about just how long you would have in certain scenarios? Like, so if you took a spoonful of peanut butter, for real, this is a real question, and you ate a whole spoonful of peanut butter, do you actually have time to like save your ass, or are you like,
oh no,
is it gonna go down like quick?
I will go into cardiac arrest in about 10 seconds.
Really? For real? Like that bad?
Jesus.
For a spoonful?
Yeah.
We need to know. We work with the lady.
How often are you... I told you not to bring it in the room. How are you getting
our listeners right now are like,
mouth?
Excuse me, Elric, but in episode 34, Becca laid it all out very clear.
Stab her in the heart.
Yeah, no, the leg.
No, but
the
I
leg.
Wonder how
the
long
leg.
It takes.
The leg.
But you like, so if you have a trace, you go into, you have your problem. But if it was like a whole thing, you would be done for.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, most likely. I've never.
Why do you want to kill Becca?
I've never exactly put this to the test. But yeah, like traces.
So you've never tried peanut butter?
I had half a peanut once.
Oh, that is not the same thing as not eating peanut butter.
Oh, and I have had small amounts
okay,
of peanut
butter. Okay, so you knew from a young age.
Like, yeah. No, this was, I've had this since I was born. So actually the very first thing that my parents tried to feed me was Reese's Puffs. So, yeah.
Kind of
it was like when they were starting me on cereal, they shoved one in my mouth and I flatlined. I don't have any cool stories.
I want to do a medical show with you where I just ask you questions about There's so much I want to know.
Yeah.
All right, what about you, Ryan?
I saw a film on Friday night called The Killing of a Sacred Deer
Oh,
by Yorgos Lanthimos. Have you seen it?
No. I wanted to go. I might get to this it this weekend. Makes me so sad, Ulrich. Let's not go spoilers. I mean, I could tell.
We'll go spoilers, but I'll read you the official synopsis because I don't want to go beyond it.
I've seen the trailer.
It's Colin Farrell plays Stephen, a charismatic surgeon, is forced to make an unthinkable sacrifice after his life starts to fall apart when the behavior of a teenage boy he has taken under his wing turns sinister. That's all you need to know. There's a great trailer that's out there.
Does that give away too much? Or
no.
Okay.
No.
I like the line where, because he's a surgeon, and the guy goes, oh, you know, his father, you know, killed him. He goes, oh, a surgeon can't kill anyone.
Yeah.
You never die if you're in surgery. Yeah. You're never killed by the surgeon. Yeah. I just like the rationalization.
It's really solid. If you've ever seen a film called Dogtooth,
yeah,
I couldn't.
The Lobster.
I had to watch Dogtooth in like six parts.
Okay.
It was horrifying
for
me.
Did you see The Lobster?
No.
All right. He did The Lobster. Lobster, I think, is
won a lot of people over. Yeah.
I really liked The Lobster. Killing a Sacred Deer is basically Yorgos' attempt.
Funny Games? Funny Games mentioned.
Funny Games, but it's like one of their crew members is one of our crew members, and I said to him, I was like, what should I expect? He's like, this is his horror movie. This is what he thinks when you go, Yorgos, go make a horror movie. This is it.
Right.
Like, this is what he wants
so
to do.
So it's not doing the self-referential thing that Funny Games does, where it becomes aware that you're watching
a movie? No. But it has it. But it has a specific rhythm to it that's a little Funny Games-ish.
Yeah.
Like the characters are, there's a rhythm to the characters, there's a feeling.
It's also European.
It's very, pacing, you know? Very European. Nicole Kidman's in it. Colin Farrell's in it. Alicia Silverstone's in it.
Oh, she's not in the trailer?
I think she pops up.
Really?
Her name pops up in the trailer, yeah.
Ooh.
Who else? Bill Camp. And then there is a fantastic young actor named Barry Keoghan.
Who's in Chris Nolan's.
Yes.
Hits his head.
He is fantastic.
Yeah.
This kid is.
He's in Dunkirk?
He's just straight up spooky.
Okay.
He is spooky motherfucker.
He didn't have much to do
his
in Dunkirk.
His IMDb picture is spooky.
Yeah. He is very spooky, but he's very good. But there's just like, I watched it with a packed ArcLight crowd, and it was phenomenal because it's at times very comedic. Like it's got that darkness to it that's just simmering and simmering. And then they undercut it with a weird fucking laugh. For instance, there's like a meeting among doctors, and they're at a party, and Colin Farrell and Nicole Kidman are there, and one of Colin Farrell's colleagues comes up to him, and he's like, oh, how's your daughter? Oh, good. Has she had her period yet? And Nicole Kidman's like, yes, absolutely. She's menstruating this week, actually.
Yeah.
And then they just like continue on. Hey, how's the chicken? You know,
what?
And you're like, what the fuck?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense given Dogtooth is like that.
So there's a lot of things that disarm you, but once Colin Farrell and the once he's rooted in what's going to happen to him, and once the stakes start to rise, it feels a little bit more realistic.
Okay.
But then he just like caps it off of more weirdness. You know, it's just very weird, very fun. Not going to be for everybody. One guy actually stood up before the last 5 minutes, which made no sense to me. He got up like 5 minutes before the movie ended, walked out, and I can hear him cursing in the ArcLight lobby. Fuck that piece of shit. Fuck that guy. Blah, blah, blah. And like and audience members were actually approaching him going, excuse me, sir, what did you hate about the film?
Yeah.
And then he's like explaining. And I was like, wow, that guy over there is going to get some therapy. Right
also,
now.
How would you not know?
Some movie therapy.
Look at the title of the movie.
Oh, I know.
If you're not expecting something in the more art house realm, it's like, come on, guys.
But
like,
he does a lot of things that disarm me, both visually, also on a sound level, the soundtrack is in a supernatural thriller.
Cool.
Like the soundtrack is lots of strings, lots of bombastic music, even during like just very quiet moments. And you're like, Jesus Christ, something bad's about to happen. And it usually does.
Yeah.
But
I can't wait. I've been looking forward to it.
Yeah. I cannot recommend this movie enough. It was put out by A24. It's an Ulrich special. It's a Ryan special. And I recommend everybody check it out.
Very cool.
Right,
Killing of a Sacred Deer.
I'm going to be quick with mine because I'm still on my 31 anthologies.
How many have you watched this week?
I'm up to whatever it is. I'm up to 24 at this point. So it's like we're almost in the home stretch. But as I think Ulrich guessed, right now I'm going to try to talk to you about them. But I can't remember what happened in which one. Like you know what I mean? Because there's like 3 to 5 stories per night. So I'll probably
just stick to the highlights if there's some good ones.
I'm trying to mix. Yeah, but the one that stood out this week, which I'd never seen, is a very famous Amicus one called Asylum.
Yeah, love
and,
it.
And I wanted to highlight that one in particular because Severin Films is putting this out. In fact, they just announced it officially as part of an Amicus box set. And it comes out as part of the box set and or individually on December 5th. And huge shout out to David Gregory from Severin and Jim Koons, who is a previous guest who works on a lot of their discs. They were kind enough to give me a check disc so that I could actually see their Blu-ray version.
Oh, and that's awesome.
It even had all the special features. There's a great like 20-minute interview with David Scout all about Robert Bloch because Robert Bloch wrote it. And so this was a great anthology, and it was one of the ones where basically the wraparound, which is kind of like this this hotshot like therapist kind of guy, is in an asylum, and they're basically like, oh, it's almost like a test for him to work there. It's like, you know, go into each individual room and see if you can diagnose
who the doctor was.
Yeah, exactly. And so so I thought that one, the new disc looks great.
And all the stories are really good in that. I like all of them.
Yeah, they're consistently all pretty solid. Of course, I am completely drawing a blank on all of them.
The
right
body
now, the
parts
second.
Wrapped into butcher
yes,
paper.
That's
I
great.
Love
yes,
that.
Yes, yes, yes.
And the so little piece with, the little toys that creatures at the end is creepy.
This, yeah, that's a great one too. Yeah. And so that's the main one that I loved. Other ones I saw included Twice Told Tales, which is a Vincent Price. Stars in all three segments, and they're all based on Nathaniel Hawthorne stories.
And Nathaniel Hawthorne.
So that one was really good.
Did he by chance do Feathertop? Was that in there?
No, that's not
it's
one
about
of the,
a scarecrow.
No, that's no, not one of the okay. stories in this one. But there's a great In fact, it was really because this was made in 1963, and the first segment is. It's kind of about two elder guys that come upon like this liquid in their lover's like tomb that is kind of the fountain of youth. But it really threw me off because, you know, you have no context of Vincent Price movies. You just watch him. And so we're looking at him. He's like, he looks pretty old in this movie. I watched it with my buddy Josh Miller. And we were like, he looks kind of old. Like, he couldn't have been that old when this came out, right? And I'm like, no, it's 1963. And like within like 15 minutes when they find the liquid, of course – he de-ages like, oh. But that's the thing is, he doesn't look that far off from how he looked as an old man later on. So that's I'm like, funny. Oh, that's actually really good makeup. Yeah. So Twice Told Tales is really great. And there's another one called Dr. Terror's House of Horrors, which is very similar. It's just five passengers on a train, including Christopher Lee and Donald Sutherland.
Mike showed this one at 16, too.
Peter Cushing was kind of the guy that – it was very similar to Tales from the Crypt in that he kind of gives them what could be an alternate, you know, future. And so those are the ones that stood out.
Oh, you mean Torture Garden didn't stand out?
Oh, yeah, I did watch that one. And I did like them, the segments, but it was – I think because you set me up for it being really boring. I kind of was expecting that.
The
wraparound's
good. The intro to those stories is cool.
Yes, really cool. With Burgess Meredith at the carnival and stuff. So
it's just like each story kind of got more dull as it went, I thought, but, you know.
Yeah, and VHS –
yeah. Which any of them stand out now?
Doesn't hold up at all.
Any?
Well, you know what? I immediately tweeted. So I'm watching VHS tonight, aka Misogyny the Movie. Yeah. Because it is way more. Like, can you imagine if that movie fucking played like Fantastic Fest this year?
Yeah.
Like, it's way worse than I remember.
It wasn't written in advance. So it's like that's all random and accidental, which makes it almost worse.
I do. I remember liking, I like Glenn McQuaid's segment because it's really weird. The thing about the VHS thing. So I was like, all right, well, at least that's different. And I still stand by the final segment. Like the radio silence bit is really fucking scary.
Oh, I don't know.
But I don't know if it works.
You don't like amateur? I think that's amazing.
I do. It is really good.
I mean, it feels misogynist, but it's about it. So it's okay.
But it's weird seeing that now after seeing Siren the movie. Yeah. And you're like, oh. Okay.
They're quite different.
And then last night I watched Three Extremes, which if you haven't seen that in a while, that movie is fucking awesome.
There's some really good intense stuff in that.
Is Dumplings one of the stories?
Dumplings is
the
first story.
Oh, the first.
It's the very first one, and they made a full feature of it, which I've never seen, but the short is great, and then the Chanwook Park one is just like unbelievable. Mm-hmm. Really, really unbelievable.
I recommend that one too.
Yeah, so that's all my anthologies for at least for now.
Holy crap, guys, get ready for it, because I've dived in parts 1 to 5 of Chucky-thon.
You did it!
This is coming from a person.
Wait, up to 5. Okay,
up to 5,
okay.
So I've got the last 2, which I've never seen, to do, which in my next week.
I'm proud
but
of
I did
you,
1 to 5.
Yeah.
The cool thing about this is I haven't rewatched these movies. I haven't rewatched Chucky 1 to 3 since they came out.
Like, so you've seen those three? Like,
I've
when
seen
when
them,
you're
but
growing
let
up.
Me let me break it. I hadn't seen. I never watched Bride, even though I've seen bits of it, and I definitely hadn't seen Seed. Okay, I'll get to these.
All right,
and you're gonna. I'll have some. I'm gonna congratulate you guys in a minute. Okay, Child's Play 1, Great movie. Yep. It really holds up. I really like the way how kind of gritty it is and how Tom Holland really just makes this kind of gritty Chicago cop action film. I love the way the reveal of Chucky, all of that's great. Holy fucking shit. I was not ready for Child's Play 2.
I know.
Just now. I'm not kidding. Here it is. It is up there in, with Fright Night 2 for me to be one of the great
this
sequels.
Guy.
This movie.
Really?
Wow.
Didn't I say last week I was like, it's
Dick,
on par with one?
Dick said that to me. Ryan talked about how great part 2 is. And I was like, I just don't remember it. Me and Dick looked at each other and we both saw these movies when they came out. Neither of us remembered this at all. We were both like, how are we forgetting how it is so well directed? It is so fun. It does everything a sequel should do. It elevates the stakes. It makes it more fun. But it still felt connected to one. It still felt grounded. Felt like a horror movie, but a fun.
Yeah,
harmony. But it's just so, like, and when you guys were talking about scores with Mancini.
Yeah, now
really,
you notice.
Yeah,
everyone
really
has a great score.
Too. And then I got to say, man, 3 for me starts to go real, real flat. All the fun and joy that I was feeling in 2, just suddenly, we watched them on the same night, just
oh,
went,
God.
and not all 5, but these 2 and 3. And it just, I remember 3 better than any of them, to be honest, for whatever reason. And I just don't really like it. And I think it's a ludicrous setup and the ending's ludicrous where it's like, hey, we're in an army base. Hey, there's a carnival. It's like, come on, fuck off. Like, you get to choose one play set, you know? I didn't really like it, but I'm going to break a Rob heart. I'm sorry. I'm breaking your heart on the next movie.
No.
I really did not get into Bride. And the tonal shift for me, this is where I was like really bummed because I like the first half. I got to say the first like 30 minutes, I was like, no, this is cool. Like I like Jennifer Tilly. I like the setup to it. But
it's a road trip.
Yeah, it's a road trip. And once they both become dolls, I just become a little less interested. Cause I turned to him at one point. I'm like, are we watching fucking Garbage Pail the movie? I kind of started feeling that. So I couldn't really get into it. I didn't hate it. It was more like, you know. And then I got to the next one, Seed.
Ooh.
And I cannot say I'm a fan. That said, I love seeing Tony Gardner. I was not expecting Tony Gardner to play a big role.
Yeah.
Like he's in it constantly as a thing.
What about John Waters?
And John Waters. So
that one makes sense.
In a weird way, it had a couple moments that I thought were almost more funny in kind of a cinema referential way than the fourth one. But it is not a good movie, and it does not all hold together. And it just made me go, and it made me – it was hard for me to believe that the movie I just watched, like, you know, a few hours earlier, and 2 and 1 were the same universe because they've by then taken them in such a different way.
Mm-hmm. See,
now I'm excited
for you to see the next 2.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's why we stopped there because I also was just by that last one, I did feel that burnout. And so I'm going to, in the next couple of days, I'll watch the next two back
Curse and Cult.
Especially which go back to
Cult,
Scary.
Curse, yeah. I'm looking for. Yeah. When everything I've heard about Curse makes me feel like I'm going to really dig it.
Yeah.
Because those first 2, man, they are great movies. And I'm not kidding. I think it's one of those rare ones where I think 2 is better than 1 in a way. On par.
Because 1 holds up really, really well.
Yeah. I hate what I hate most about myself right now.
Why do you hate
Tom Holland? I love Tom Holland.
Why do you hate
And I love Fright Night 1 and I love Reddit. But there's something about both sequels. I think both sequels just knew how to take what you already done the ground.
Someone does a thinner 2 and Elric's like,
I love that thinner 2. It's much better.
Yeah. No, his Langoliers 2 is something I have been looking for. But anyway, it was fun to do it like this, I got to say. But man, yeah, that Seed. And I know the cool thing is somebody loves Seed. I want to hear from the
people who love Seed. Fans, yeah.
The worst thing about Seed is the Seed of Chucky. Like the other 2 are
Glenn
fine.
And Glenda.
That thing is just like, I'm like, I don't know if I can get into this.
Don knows my feelings about Seed. And I just like, I feel like it just pushed an envelope too far.
Yeah.
And I don't, I like the themes and all that stuff, but it was just like, it's over the top silly. And then,
you know, what's cool though, because Don's been involved in all this, especially if what you're also telling me about the next 2 is true. Then great read on the barometer that he had.
Oh, yeah.
Like, that's a great read to take something back. And you know,
absolutely.
But I enjoyed doing it. So Chucky-thon had begun. That'll be my main kind of Halloween thing.
That's wonderful.
This year. It's fun.
Mm-hmm. All right. What else you guys got?
Well, I watched a lot of television this week. Right. So I'm still enjoying American Horror Story this season. I know. It's weird. Have you been keeping up?
No, I fell off.
I fell off at 2, but I have an entire season on my iTunes I need to watch. So
It has gotten fascinating for me because it is about kind of the formation of a cult and how this guy, you know, comes out. Like in the beginning, you thought that he was very much like right wing, but then it gets into like how he's recruiting people from both sides and the psychological, you know, what he's doing psychologically with people. Mm. it's still kind of fascinating with me. So I'm still on American Horror Story. Sweet. The Exorcist. Have you guys been watching The Exorcist show?
I've got it on my DVR. Yeah. I haven't watched any of them yet.
I'm really liking it.
Is it a different story, guys?
Completely.
Yeah, but it's really.
So I can just jump in?
Different town, too, I've heard.
It's, well, it jumps towns. Okay. Like, it starts with the two priests in the Midwest, but then you're also getting flashes of this foster home in Seattle, Portland, or I think it's Seattle area. And then the priests end up kind of making their way up to there for other reasons. And then it all kind of converges in Seattle on an island. But
we'll catch
I'm
up
really
after,
liking it.
And we'll talk about it. But before we move on, I want to give a double shout out to Rob for recommending that Behind the Scenes Exorcist podcast, which I listened to all four of in the last 2 days.
Yeah,
and I'm really enjoying it. It's really fun. It's short bursts, 30 minutes.
Oh,
but,
really?
But there's some fun.
Inside the Exorcist.
Inside
yeah.
the Exorcist. Nice. But it's there's only seven altogether that's going to come out. But it was fun. I've been enjoying it. You just get like, it's like reading the little book about it.
Yeah,
just,
it's fun.
In the voice of the characters. Nice. It's cool.
Yeah, so that show, if you haven't been checking it out, I recommend it. Have you guys been watching Lore?
I watched the first episode.
What'd you think?
It's like the podcast.
Yeah, that's what it was. I mean, it was the exact
with like reenactments. It's like
yeah, it was.
It's basically the format is Aaron Mankey still does the narration. He still writes. I thought I was actually going to see Aaron in the flesh, like kind of host it. But basically, they just it's the format of the podcast. But then there are. You know, like vignettes and stock footage and animation.
I've heard they all change, though, each episode. Like, I watched the first, like, 20 seconds. I was like, oh, okay, it's the same thing. Turned off.
See, yeah,
I'll get to it when I have energy. But
I watched the first one and wasn't too into it, so I'm now looking for encouragement to keep going.
We might toss it on. What was funny is that the other night before we went to bed, Sierra was like, so I would toss on Lore because you could close your eyes and still think you're watching, listening to the podcast.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, yeah, that's
yeah.
true.
Yeah, and well, the two things that I noticed with it is usually when you have these shows that kind of tell a story and then reconstruct them with stock footage and some reenactments, things like Forensics Files or Cold Case Files, is kind of the formula it was following. They're half an hour. Yeah. So the hour felt kind of long, but then again, his podcast is kind of long. And then the other thing, and I was watching this with people who had never seen the podcast before, were immediately like, this guy does not have a TV voice. And I then realized what they were saying is he has, you know, he's been doing his podcast from the start. So if you listen to the Lore podcast, which I did, you know, you're familiar with that voice, but he does not sound like someone who would be narrating a TV show. So
I disagree with that. I think he's got a very warm and engaging voice that kind of tells a story very well. That's
there
why
are a lot of people online I read who do have issues with voice. I'm sure it's just like anyone's voice.
Yeah,
this is
an Amazon Prime exclusive, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes,
yeah, because I added it to my queue, and they all seem to be different lengths. Like
that's what I've heard.
38 minutes, 47 minutes, like they're a little bit different
each time.
The
first one was almost an hour, and I remember thinking, like, this seems to be going a little long. But that said, I'm looking for encouragement to keep going, because the first one I'm a little mixed on, so I want to keep going.
I might hop around episodes, you know, just kind of find something that pertains to me. And
the main thing is they aren't the same stories as the podcast, which I was concerned that they would be things we might, but they're all new.
That's cool. Yeah,
no, the first one that I watched, the stories themselves were interesting. It was about people who were buried alive, specifically like people who were perceived to be dead, but then turned out to be alive and kind of the stories that happened therein. So, yeah.
Right on. What about you, Ryan? Anything else?
Yeah, I watched The Devil's Reign.
Oh!
Robert Fuest, The Devil's Reign. the funny thing about Devil's Reign is I realized I'd never seen it in its entirety from beginning to end. I've only seen chunks. So the movie was directed by Robert Fuest, who did Abominable Dr. Fibes and the Dr. Fibes sequel. And this is just pure 70s satanic fear kind of movie. And it literally jumps right into the action. You've got William Shatner returning home to see his mother, and they just like the dialogue is just automatically engaged. She's like, where is he? I don't know. Are they after the book? It's Corbis. And it's like, oh my God, there's so much information being thrown at me. What is going on? Basically, Ernest Borgnine plays a Satan worshiper who is after a book, and you discover that this villain Corbis has been on Earth for a very, very long time. We get those flashbacks, and he's after a book, so he goes after Shatner's family, who seem to know where the book is. He discovers Shatner's family's got a long legacy with Corbis, and then Shatner is kidnapped in the first 10 minutes, and then enter Tom Skerritt.
Everyone's on this thing,
And Tom Skerritt comes in and he's like, yo, where's my brother? All the and it's all very done very like on a very low budget. So you've got a ghost town, you've got this church out in the middle of nowhere, and then you've just got a bunch of fucking Satan worshipers that
and
are just on the attack.
Face melting.
But to get to the payoff, yeah. which is like 20 minutes of melting in the last yeah. like last act, you just got to get through a lot of repetitive chase. Where's the book? I don't know. Chase. Where's the book? Flashback. Chase. And then it's like, finally, there's a big showdown. And it's a lot of fun.
Is it?
But there's not much to it. And it's very confusing sometimes.
I recall, and I have not seen this since I was probably in high school. I recall being bored by it.
There's definitely stretches of, and I think it just comes from narrative repetition.
Yeah, but if a movie goes all out by the end, all is forgiven with me. I remember being in an all-nighter watching this a couple years back at the Arrow, and I was just like, when it got to the good stuff, I was like, this is awesome. I didn't care
but even in the goopy gore stuff, yeah. the funny thing is it just lingers a little too long. Yeah, we're like, so you see all right, come on, the rain, I get it.
I know probably I'll ask what everyone's probably wanting to ask. Is it mustache or non-mustache scare?
Mustache.
Okay, so it's watchable.
Yeah.
Him without a mustache.
I recall it very.
It's a weird face without a mustache.
You just can't watch him without a
Severin,
mustache.
The Severin Blu-ray looks beautiful. That I jumped automatically to a 1974-75 interview with William Shatner on the set of something while he's like sitting in a chair eating lunch. And it's just this like, it's a newsman standing there with the microphone interviewing William Shatner, and it jumps right in. And guess what he's being asked about?
What's that?
Star Trek The Motion Picture.
Oh, wow. Cool.
Which had not existed yet. I mean, like, he was just basically like, yeah, you know, I think, you know, I haven't, you know, I know that they've engaged a writer to write a script, but as far as someone coming to me saying, we want you back and we will pay you, that hasn't happened yet.
Wow.
And then he went on, and then he kind of went on about maybe playing Kirk again would kind of be a step back. So maybe he wouldn't take the motion picture.
Wow.
So it is
plus he had
fantastic.
To clear his schedule for visiting hours. An exploitation for you.
Yeah. It was good stuff. But The Devil's Reign fit squarely into my kind of like October horror movie marathon, because sometimes you just got to throw in some 1970s satanic fear.
That would be a fun one if we were going to a group Halloween party all together where we all go as Devil Reign characters.
All dressed as Devil's Reign.
I tweeted. I was like, I'm just going to come and I'm just going to start melting all over everybody.
Oh, that's great.
I could just be like Snickers. I'll paint. Yeah. I'll glue Snickers to my face. Becca, you hold
I can't get near you.
Oh, shit.
You put Snickers on your face, dude. I'm on the other side.
Did you hear the top of the show?
But we got like 30 seconds.
give me some chocolate. I'll put it on my
shoot
face.
In the heart.
Like some sort of like goopy candy, and then you could just
caramel.
Blow dry
you
me.
You can do caramel.
And then I could just
caramel.
Melt. How about that?
Okay.
All right. Now we're on to something.
I think I got a plan.
All right, anything else, guys?
No, that was it. Chuckathon,
all right.
baby.
All right, Chuckathon. All right, I can't wait to hear your follow-up.
Yeah, I'll do them next
week. All
right,
well, let's hear from one more sponsor, and then we'll be back with our guests.
In need of great talent for your business but on short time? You don't have to get lost in a huge stack of resumes to find your perfect hire. You just need the right tools. Smarter tools. With ZipRecruiter, you can boast your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards with just one click, so you can rest easy knowing your job is being seen by the right candidates. Then, ZipRecruiter puts its smart matching technology to work, actively notifying qualified candidates about your job within minutes of posting, so you receive the best possible matches. That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other hiring sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on the right candidates finding you. It finds them. No wonder 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through their site in just one day. It's easy to use ZipRecruiter's dashboard, which lets you manage your hiring process from start to finish, all in one place. ZipRecruiter is the smartest way to hire. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by growing businesses of all sizes and industries to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, our listeners can post on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/shock. That's ZipRecruiter.com/shock. One more time, try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/shock.
All All right, to get you in the spooky spirit of Halloween, I think you kind of need music in your life.
Yep.
I've been spinning a lot of records this week.
Not my mix?
Your mix is in my car, Rob.
All right, okay, just making sure.
And usually it is the stuff that I listen to in the morning. You know, I tried the Witch soundtrack, and that is really aggressive and weird. And when the witches are chanting, it's not what you want to listen to while you're making oatmeal.
Is this what you listen to sometimes, morning? Yeah. Morning?
Yeah. And then the kid shouts from upstairs and says, "What are you listening to?" And I'm like, "Oh, it's the witch."
Yeah. But great for making love. So good.
Aggressive and dark.
And theme of this week, I've been digging into the library of Waxwork Records.
I like those guys.
I like those guys, too. They most recently released Creepshow 2 and Dark Man.
Friday 4,
which I'm waiting for, along with my giant fucking pin set I bought.
Do you want to complain directly to the person responsible?
Oh my God, Kevin here?
The little FAQ is sitting here.
Be one of those guys, Ryan.
We got Kevin Bergeron in the house from Waxwork Records. We also got Douglas Pipes as an added bonus.
Composer
of Trick or Treat.
This is like a twofer.
And
this is
most
awesome.
Recently, The Babysitter, which we discussed on the last episode.
And Krampus,
which is on my playlist every Halloween.
And shout out to the McGarris podcast that had Doherty on this week.
Oh, that's
and
right.
I just listened to him in the car.
What a nice compliment.
As he talked about both movies. So.
Nice.
It was a great episode.
Nice. Guys, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Kevin, you have traveled long ways.
I have, yes, New Orleans.
But you're in town for a super cool thing. When this airs, it would have happened already.
Yes.
But basically, you guys are putting out The Exorcist, and you're doing an event with William Friedkin.
Yeah, tomorrow at Amoeba Music. And William's going to be there, and he's going to be signing copies of the record. And it's really exciting. We've been working on The Exorcist for years now at this point. It's kind of like one of those things because we always talk about how long it takes to release one of these records, one of these soundtracks, because the licensing and everything that goes into it. But The Exorcist has taken the cake, honestly. I've been working on it for 4 years, almost 5 years.
Wow. So is this one of the first titles you were trying to go for?
Yeah. We had a library list of things that we wanted, a wish list rather. And The Exorcist obviously was right there at the top. Mm-hmm. So we wanted to release that. And it was a lot of searching for the rights and, locating the masters, the original masters, because that's kind of the thing that we specialize in. And actually getting William Friedkin on board as well too, But what's funny is that reaching out to him, I was reaching out to him for another title that we're working with him on. We're releasing the soundtrack to Cruising.
Yes. And that's going to be Oh my God, I'm wearing leather chaps as we speak.
Yeah.
This is hot.
So and it's going to be this crazy expanded thing. It's probably going to be a quadruple LP.
Holy shit.
It's amazing. It's
that
be
is
great.
Some love for Cruising right there.
An extra vinyl of just James Franco dancing.
Yeah.
Nice.
But so reaching out, trying to get in touch with him for, information about Cruising, I was wait, we're actually doing The Exorcist as well. And would you be down with giving us liner notes? And he was obviously on board. He's really cool. He's actually really legit. I mean, he's one of those guys that he's just real, really real, everything that he says has this kind of purpose, he doesn't just shoot the shit and just kind of say things just kind of just to say them. Everything has this really kind of aura of importance, and it's really cool and respected. I mean, it's so cool.
The two best Q&As I've ever been to, both are freaking really.
Yeah,
one
yeah.
with him and Tobe Hooper, and one after Sorcerer, and they're just watching a master raconteur, and because a lot of it is real, he grounds it and just talks from the hip.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and
yeah.
I love that about
he's
him.
Really, he's cool. One of the coolest guys, and he has this kind of encyclopedia knowledge of just cinema. So it's really cool, and music too. We talked about LA punk rock. For a long time, it was really weird. He just started talking about X and the Germs and all this stuff. And I was this is amazing. We're talking about I'm talking about punk rock with William Friedkin right now. This is so rad.
Now, have you ever talked to, I have to ask, because you're also putting out the, I don't know when, but at some point in the future, you're also putting out a 10-inch of the Lalo Schifrin Rejected Score.
That's kind of a maybe. It's we really want to do it and we have the rights to do it, but it's kind of out of respect for, for William, honestly, because it was rejected, back in the day, and he and I spoke about it for a very long time.
That was my question. Did you?
So it's kind of
talk to Friedkin.
So it's on the table. Waxwork could definitely do it. We could release it, but I'm just kind of out of respect, I want to wait and make sure that like he's okay with it, you know, because I just don't, you know, I don't want to just, I think other companies would just like put the shit out, but like, you know, me, I'm just.
What happened at the time? Like, I just, through that moment when they're actually putting the film, did they just score it and he was like, it doesn't work, I need Oldfield and something crazy?
Well, from what I know from like what he told me, that like he tried getting Bernard Herrmann to do the score for The Exorcist and like it didn't work out. Apparently Herrmann was like, you know, really, and he loves him. He still respects like Herrmann to this day. Like he feels as if course, like that's like the, you know, number one.
Yeah.
But like, it didn't work out. And then like, he honestly, he tried getting, you know, Schifrin, and then like Schifrin actually composed like a bunch of music and I've heard it all. And it's like, awesome. It's really awesome. But it wouldn't have worked for The Exorcist because it's like so bombastic. I mean, it's like an 80 piece orchestra and it doesn't go with like
interesting,
you know. And I understand.
Heard it, it's pretty
cool. I haven't heard it. No, yeah, he did Amityville too, right? I've always thought that was a really beautiful score, you know, really kind of, but it wouldn't feel right on Exorcist at all. Like,
no, from what I've heard, and then like, you know, and then what, you know, he told me he just wasn't happy with it and like it was kind of like a little contentious for a little while. So, like, so yeah, like out of respect, I'm kind of like just backing off and like waiting until like it's okay to do it, you know, just like. Using some finesse, but
Say how he discovered Oldfield? Because the one thing we did see at the Sorcerer, I don't know if you're at that one.
I wasn't.
He talks about how he discovered Tangerine Dream.
Yeah,
and that he's like in some German jungle, and they take him out in the middle of nowhere, and it's dark.
Yeah,
and his band just
what?
Starts playing.
Yeah, the only lights apparently were coming from like Tangerine Dream's like synths.
And he had no idea what it was, and he was just out there going, "Oh my!" and blows his mind, and then he just records it and
how
then plays it
to
the
to
movie.
Begin with?
How did he get to Germany? He was probably there for a different movie or something.
That's crazy.
But it was one of those stories where you're like, oh, that's kind of a, what I like about, because he was actually my first favorite director when I was like young. He was, him and Polanski were like the two first directors I noticed. And Friedkin, I remember all the negative stories that were coming out after Sorcerer. But then when you go back to that work, you're like, this is a guy who was clearly instinctual. Mm-hmm. Like he went with his gut. Like, oh, he heard that music, that becomes the music. And he just grabs it. So I wondered how he discovered Oldfield, because I don't know much about Mike Oldfield stuff before.
He talks about it a lot in the liner notes that he gave us for The Exorcist, which it's funny because like apparently like he wanted to find like a theme song for The Exorcist, and like he I forget like what movie studio, it was like a new studio at the time, but like they just allowed him to kind of like go into like this room full of like records, and he needle dropped for like 3 days straight, just like thousands of records, like trying to find that track. And you know, Tubular Bells already existed, you know, it was like on a record or whatever. And like when he finally found it, he's like, that's the track, like that's the one that I want. And they were like, seriously, you want that song, Tubular Bells? And he's like, yeah, that's it, that's gonna be like the theme to The Exorcist. And like they were like, okay, you can have it, you know.
It's pretty far
there's out. A little bit much more to it, but I mean, you know, it's in the liner notes.
It's like how he found Regan, right? We were listening to the podcast about him finding Regan. It's like the 1001 girl is the one he cast. He has to go through 1,000 people and then that's the person.
And it's just, it's really remarkable that like some of like the most amazing like things that happen like in cinema or like, you know, scoring or whatever, like just kind of like just like off the cuff things, you know, just like
I was gonna ask Douglas, I mean, how does The Exorcist score impacted you, if it, in any way, if it has, in terms of your career?
I can't say that that's one that's sort of the one of the key
stuck
ones
out,
for me. No,
yeah.
I sort of was born and bred on Jerry Goldsmith stuff. My roots go deep into Poltergeist and Magic. And,
nice.
Yeah.
Psycho 2, baby.
I just saw Magic at the new
band. Oh, you're right.
That played really well, but it was Goldsmith's score that just stands out. And they were playing it beforehand, which was like, it was nice. It was a nice touch.
I was talking with somebody a couple days ago who was trying to tell me that Magic needed to be remade and that it's like ripe for a remake right now and everybody would love it. And I feel like I need to revisit it now. I don't remember.
We don't know about that.
I need, because it's
all performance based, you know, and he did a great performance then.
Well, let's go back to the beginning, because we do this with everybody, and obviously I have a lot of questions in terms of, you know, because, you know, when we have the guys that do the Blu-ray labels, they all have slightly different ways they go about it.
And,
you know, we've heard from some record labels, but I definitely want to know that.
Yeah.
But where did this love of horror begin for both of you? What was the first movie that really scared the crap out of you, but at the same time you're like, I want more of that? Like, what was the one that did it to you?
Like, for me personally, as far back as I can remember, like, that's the kind of stuff that, like, I was always into, like, scary horror movies. And, like, it actually caused problems within my household because my parents thought that I had a problem or something. You know, like, putting, like, posters of, like, Freddy and stuff, like, from, like, magazines and on the wall, like, just wasn't cool to them. So, very conservative, you know. But, like, I don't know exactly where it started, but I know it was always there as far back as I can remember. So, 80s slasher stuff like Friday the 13th and like A Nightmare on Elm Street and then like 70s stuff like Halloween. But yeah, I mean, like, it just, that's what I've always been obsessed with is just like scary movies. It doesn't matter if like they're shitty or like, you know, like classics. Like, it just had to be dark and people had to be getting hurt.
You know? Are you originally from New Orleans?
Yeah, I'm from New Orleans. Okay. Yeah. Maybe that has something to do with it too, because it's like scary and dark.
Yeah,
and
I was going to say, it's got some really fascinating culture to it that, it does, that has a lot of kind of ghost vibes.
It looks like Dracula's house. I mean, it's really, anytime that I take a photo of like the architecture there or something and like, or just like randomly just have some sort of photo that I, like Jay Shaw, for example, who's done like a lot of artwork for us in the beginning.
Love Jay. He used to do our stuff for Fangoria as well.
Yeah, he's killer. He's awesome. I know that artwork that you're talking about too. Yeah, it's awesome. It's really good. He saw a photo, like just some random photo on my Instagram. And he's like, "What are you doing hanging out like in like Transylvania?" Like, I'm like, "Dude, this is New Orleans. Like, this is literally like next door to my house." It's just everything is old and everything's dark and scary and it's a heavy town. So like maybe that has some sort of like contribution to like why I'm into like its lifestyle. I don't know, but yeah, like, that's. I hope that answers your question.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of similar to all our stories. Yeah. But what about for you, Douglas?
So the very first movie that just scared the everything out of me was Dawn of the Dead. Like, I couldn't sleep at night. I had to shut all my closet doors and freak out. And it was really bad.
How'd you get to see it? Was it in the theaters?
Yeah, I saw it in the theaters. And then, like, Phantasm was another one. That silver ball. God, crazy.
And for both of you, when did you, you know, it's funny because me and Elric were talking about this on his other podcast is, you know, when do you realize how like important and pivotal the music is to like a horror film? Like for us, we're like, I think just from Jaws and Halloween, it's
themes.
Like,
it's like
you all of a sudden realize
creatures.
Like, oh yeah, that's the music that, you know, it's the character basically. Like when you hear the Jaws theme, the shark's there. When you hear Halloween, Michael Myers is obviously there. And eventually you realize like, oh, that's the music that's making me feel that way. So did either of you have that kind of moment just from any film?
Certainly Halloween does it. And of course Jaws does it because it's such that omnipresent that the music tells you, don't turn around because something's right there, or don't look down, or whatever. The other one, sort of musically, again, going back to Poltergeist, just the sort of the dynamic of it. You know, Carol Ann's theme just brings you down, and you're all good, and then everything, as it gets harder core, it really kicks in. And it's the fantastical element of that musically that was the hook for me. That was by and far. My favorite horror score. It's the Star Wars of horror scores to me.
And how did you both get into your respective field now? Meaning, we'll start with you, Douglas. So did you know that you wanted to be a composer? Was that something that was kind of ingrained early on?
No. So I took my high school graduation money and bought a synthesizer and joined a band and did all that stuff. And then decided someone came up to me and asked me to score their movie while I was in this band. And I did it, and I scored a couple of movies, and I really liked doing it, but I thought I wasn't that good at it. So I stopped, and I went to university and studied composition and orchestration, and I wanted to really be a composer and not just a sort of keyboard player who makes music. So I stopped taking work, and then when I was in school, after a few years, I started taking up student films and kind of re-engaging in it, wanting to right where I felt confident with what I was doing. And from there I met Gil Kenan and did all his short films in school. And then his master's thesis, it was a hybrid animation, live action, and that kind of got tossed around town. And he landed an agency and then got the attention of Steven Spielberg and Robert Zemeckis, and they gave him Monster House. And then he did this incredible thing, which was, this is my composer. I want to bring him on to a $100 million movie at Sony. This guy's never done anything. Okay. Yeah. But it really was, you know, the producers in Spielberg and Image Movers that said, after I demoed some stuff, they go, okay, clearly he's got it. So we'll walk you through this and get all the sign-offs to happen as they go. And I ended up basically mocking up the whole score and testing it. And then when that process went down and it all worked, I got the gig.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Nice.
Well, what did, are any demos of your band still out there? I'm just curious if we can find your Coupe de Villes.
There might be.
Yeah.
Not on the internet, though.
Really? All right. I'm going to hunt them down. And what about you, Kevin? I feel like you I'm going to sense that you were probably in a band at some point in your life. I'm sorry. We could sense our own.
Yeah. Various bands, like roughing it, doing a lot of like things and not getting paid. You know, like touring and recording and like coming out of pocket, which I mean is okay because like that's what it's like, you know.
What kind of stuff was it?
Hardcore punk, like fast, loud, abrasive, you know, like oppressively loud. Like we always wanted to be the loudest. Like everyone in the band that played guitar had a full stack or two.
I love that.
And like so that like just for years, I mean like maybe 15 years of just doing that straight. Sometimes like being on the road for like months and months at a time. So one of the bands that I was in called The Picks. The Picks were on the road for like 3 years straight at one point.
Oh my gosh.
Luckily, this was before I joined the band.
I was going to say, this sounds like deadening inside.
Yeah, it was kind of like, it was like this like black flag way of doing things that like we just had like this kind of like aesthetic that we were like going for. But that got old after a while. I was in a band and like my last band, She's Still Dead, like we toured Cuba and it was all my idea and like, you know, we fought really hard to like, you know, go play there.
Why Cuba?
How do you tour Cuba?
No one had ever done it yet. Like there's other bands that have done like, you know, like one-offs, like big bands, like massive bands, but I was like, let's tour the entire island.
Now, are they like really into hardcore punk there? Did you have you're big in Cuba?
Because of the embargo and all that, you know, like any sort of American band going there, like you may as well be like Metallica. So like every show was just like that, like a sea of people. Like you couldn't play inside any venue because they couldn't hold that many people. It was just like in parks outside.
That's great.
So it was really crazy. And like, so it didn't matter that like we were kind of like a small band from the US because like playing there is just like, it's like, whoa, Slayer's here, you know?
Wow.
So that was really fun. But like when we got back, I mean, all of the other guys in the band didn't want to do it, but I was like really excited. I was like, let's do this crazy shit. And I booked it and like we came back and like it just everything started like toppling over and falling down and everyone wanted to quit and they didn't like coming out of pocket for it, which I can respect. But I already had the wheels turning to start a record label at that point because like I knew that something was going to like just end the band at some point, like me kicking out the singer or whatever. And the drummer didn't want to pay rent for the band room or whatever. So like we got together and I was like, I was going to kick out the singer this one night and the entire band was there and like he quit before I could kick him out. It was insane. Like he knew that I was going to do it. And then like, so I just turned to the drummer and I'm like, well, you're out of here. You know, you don't pay rent. And like, it just, everything got really ugly, really fast.
Oh man.
And at this point I had already licensed Reanimator. Like there was like, I don't think, wow. You know, Waxwork was even like a thing yet. Like, you know, we just trying to like me and my partner, Susie, that, you know, co-owns the label with me. We had already licensed Reanimator at this point, and we already had the wheels in motion to license Day of the Dead and Creepshow from John Harrison.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So, like, I was like, all right, great. Like, I want to work now from behind the curtain. You know, like, I love playing, and, like, I still have, like, this kind of – it's like a phantom limb. Like, I want to play live so bad, and it's just, like, this therapeutic, cathartic thing for me. But, like, it's really rewarding being able to, like, drive the bus and, like, run a record label that's successful and, like, work with people, like – that are professional, like Douglas Pipes, people that actually like have studied music and they get it and they understand it and they're cool and they're just awesome to work with. All of the composers that we've worked with have been awesome. So yeah, like that's kind of like it in a nutshell. Like I came from like this really like going, and I attribute like a lot of like that hard, you know, time, I guess, like playing in the bands rather. There was a lot of steam pushing. And that I kind of applied that kind of like that steam to like Waxworks. It was just like I just dived right in, you know.
But you're in a band, mm-hmm. and you'd already acquired the rights to put out Reanimator.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So you would think you'd put out your band's record or something like that.
I
so
did.
Why
that's,
were you thinking soundtracks?
Oh well, like to backtrack a little bit, like I love listening to like vinyl is like my favorite medium of like listening to like recorded music. I think it's like the best way of listening. Flawed and all, whatever. I really enjoy records. I always have. And we, I guess like when you play in a punk band long enough, like you're going to cut a record at some point, like a 7-inch or whatever. So like, I have years of experience, not only being in a recording studio, but also pressing records, like just doing it myself. paying for it, like just learning how to do it, you know. And I mean, to answer your question about soundtracks, like I'm a fan of horror. Like, I love film music. I always have. I know it's kind of like everyone keeps talking about John Carpenter, but it's like he's the coolest. Like, there's who the fuck is cooler than John Carpenter right now or ever? You know, is it okay to curse on this?
Yes, yeah, yeah. Sure.
That's fucking fine.
All right, great, great. It's amazing that his career is kind of like seeing another like uprising with Sacred Bones and stuff. It's so rad. So like Halloween is kind of like the one that got me into it on the I guess like score side. You know, like it's just like this. It's Halloween, the theme from Halloween. Like, what else is better than that?
Yeah.
So yeah, like I just decided like let's start a record label that releases soundtracks on vinyl. Like the bands that I was playing in were like horror bands. Like everything was like, you know, the songs were about horror. It wasn't like the Misfits or anything. It was like way faster. But like yeah, it was just kind of like this nice segue from doing the band that was like scary and spooky to doing like a record label that was scary and spooky.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I'm curious because you were, you know, timing's everything, and it seems like yeah. You guys were kind of coming out at a time when this horror soundtrack on vinyl
for sure
revival yeah. was like just on the cusp of happening.
Oh, yeah.
And so, at what point did you realize like, oh shit, we're onto something. This could be a real thing, because you'd had Reanimator yeah. and Day of the Dead
Rosemary's
and Rosemary's Baby.
Yeah, Rosemary. Yeah.
So was it like, was it kind of early on that you're like, this is, you know, we could do this full time maybe?
It really didn't dawn on me that we could do this like as for like a career. And like until like we were like four or five releases deep, because I mean like we didn't actually like see a profit until like after Creepshow or Chopping Mall, one of those. Yeah, like I was terrified. You know, when we acquired the rights to Reanimator, I was, the night before we put it on sale, like I had already dumped all kinds of, I sold all of my gear from the band, and like, you know, I tried taking out a loan and I kept getting like denied, because like who's gonna like want to like give a loan? Like a bank is not gonna give a loan to someone that's trying to start a record label releasing vinyl. Everyone was just like, you're crazy. Family members thought I was crazy, and maybe, I don't know, they're right to some degree. But like I was terrified, and I just couldn't sleep, and I was like, what if no one buys this stuff? You know, like I dumped all this money into like releasing this record and licensing it and everything.
How did you get it out? Like, how do you inform everyone that you're selling this?
Social media. Yeah. Yeah, social media. If it wasn't for like Instagram and like Twitter and Facebook, like I not only Waxwork, but I think like the majority of companies right now would just be like, they wouldn't exist.
Yeah.
You know, like especially Instagram, like that's like number one, mm-hmm. really. But yeah, like it just, you know, we put it on sale and I was like, all right, here we go. We're going to sell like two copies, and it sold out within like 24 hours. I was like, holy shit. But, you know, then we had to like, okay, we got to work on the next one, because we got, you know, we have a lot of expenses and stuff, and like, you know, we're obligated to do it now. Like, you know, we have a contractual obligation to like, you know, do this thing with John Harrison. So like, and then, you know, there was like this kind of like, and I'm not trying to pat myself on the back, but like this big explosion thing happened after Rosemary's Baby, because it showed that like this small company from New Orleans was able to get something with like a major studio like Paramount. And up until that point, like other companies doing it were just doing kind of stuff like B movies, like, you know, nothing like, nothing from like a major, major studio, and nothing on like the level of like Rosemary's Baby, because like that's, I mean, it's one of the greatest.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, Christoph Kameda, and like, you know, it's just like this classic movie. So yeah, like that, this explosion happened, and then it got really competitive. Everyone like just kind of like buckled down, and they're all like, all right, shit, like let's, everyone started taking trips to LA and meeting at studios and like just scooping up everything.
Everybody's scrambling for titles.
Yeah. And it like really fast, like, I mean, like us and, you know, like Mondo and everyone else, like we just like scooped up like everything, you know, like a lot of stuff. But, you know, I really enjoy working on like contemporary stuff too, like modern shit.
Well, how did Trick or Treat come along?
Trick or Treat, I absolutely love the movie. Like, again, my partner mm-hmm. Susie that started the label with me, she introduced me to the movie back like when it came out,
yeah.
And like no one was really talking about it. And I'm like, this is fucking amazing. This is so good. Like, why isn't this like? Why didn't it get a theatrical run? You know, this is great. This is a great movie.
Saw did that.
Saw, well, yeah, possibly.
Actually, I remember Doherty saying that in an interview that we did with him for Fangoria, that they had made the movie and acquired it, but then by that time Saw was raining, and there was this belief that you don't go against Saw at Halloween. And because
that's
Saw
part of it. But you know what, actually the podcast that we were just listening to, that he was on Mick Garris's podcast this mm-hmm. week, and he made, you know, it's interesting in retrospect when you look back mm-hmm. and stuff. And he said, he's like, look, from a studio level, he's like, I'm not mad at anybody anymore, but from a studio level, it's like they're obligated to get the new Harry Potter movie in theaters, and it's kind of like any money put towards this little movie that's not guaranteed is taking away from Harry Potter, which is going to keep the company going for another X amount of years. I thought it was really smart and interesting the way because he's like, you know what, I'm actually thankful that it all worked out the way it did, because now it's this cool cult movie that everybody loves.
Like, Sam tattoos and stuff.
Yeah, people rallied behind it because it did get such kind of a dismissive
release. They got to discover
that was a weird time too, though, because like a lot of those movies coming, either Michael told me this or I read it somewhere, like, but at that time it was like a lot of like torture porn movies.
Yeah.
Like,
it was.
Hostel, and a lot of like, we were coming off of like that whole like the Ring and The Grudge and all those movies, and like the studios were all like werewolves and zombies and mummies and shit, like who's gonna want to watch that? Like, you're thinking old school, dude. And Michael's so smart, he's just like, no dude, like that shit is like timeless, like it's endless, like it's never gonna go away. People always are gonna want to see Frankenstein and vampires, and like that's classic shit, and that's what Trick or Treat is. It's like, it's timeless, and it's gonna be like 20 years from now, people are still going to be talking about it and getting Sam tattoos and stuff.
I got to tell you, the first time I saw it, actually, I was still living in New York, and I think you were there too, Becca. But
at the screening in New York where Fangoria
did the two boots, and it was a double bill of Trick or Treat with Let the Right One In.
And it was amazing.
Yeah, and because of all those movies you just mentioned that were coming out at that time, it's like, as a horror fan, you see those two movies in the middle, and you're like, holy shit. Like, there is good shit still out there.
I think I've told this story on our old show, Killer POV, but I don't think I've told it on Shockwaves yet. I was working at Fangoria when that was going on. I was already the director of marketing then. And we had been told that somebody would be dropping off the reels for Trick or Treat that day.
Yeah.
And so
first screening ever. I think.
Yeah, it was one of the first theatrical screenings of it, because it hadn't done any festivals or anything yet. And everyone else had headed over to the theater, and I was finishing up at the office, and they were like, somebody's bringing the reels. Just bring the reels with you when you come. Just catch a cab, bring the reels over to the theater, because they were there prepping for Let the Right One In, which we showed first. And so I'm getting ready to leave, and this guy shows up, and he's like, here are the reels. And I thought it was like an intern, and it was Mike. Like bringing
himself
the reels to the theater himself. Because I was like, I thought it was just like a runner from the studio. And I was like, oh, thanks, I'll take these. I got to catch a cab. And he was like, oh, I have to go to the theater too. And I was like, oh, you're coming too? And he was like, well, I made the movie. And I was like, oh, shit, you're Mike. So, but literally like carrying the reels around New York City.
Wow.
Yeah, to answer your question, Ryan, about like how we got it, like I reached out before reaching out to Legendary or Warner or any of those companies. Like I reached out to Mike first. I like just emailed him out of the blue. Yeah. And I was like driving. And I remember like he called me, and like, you know, we started like talking about it, and it was almost like I was kind of like asking for like his blessing, because like at that time, like I like, especially with like contemporary stuff, like I really love being able to work, you know, obviously like having a podcast right now with Douglas, you know, like being able to work directly with these people and like call them up and like work with them. So I called up Mike, and like we talked about it, and then like, you know, he kind of set the wheels in motion for us to like, you know, start talking with Legendary, and yeah.
That's cool. So Doug, take us back to the origins of the score. There's some pretty great themes in the Trick or Treat soundtrack, including the opening. The kind of I don't want to recreate it and kill your work, but I every time I put it on, I just smirk because it's got such a playful tone to it, almost in that Goldsmith sort of way,
like Mike's enthusiasm for Halloween and just this story. So I'm wondering, how did that get you pumped and excited to do this too?
Yeah, and we started off talking. It just, I mean, real sort of love for all the same types of musical approaches to horror movies. You know, the melodic approach, the dynamic approach, where it's not just sort of all droney or sound designy or all hard hitting, but it has melodies and it goes down and lulls you into a sense of tranquility and then hits you over the head. And just talked about Jerry Goldsmith and even back to Bernard Herrmann and Halloween, and all these great scores, and talked about why they worked. And he was in Vancouver. I hadn't met him. He was in Vancouver, and I went out for a screening. We talked some more stuff, and I took the film and came back. And then just sitting at my piano, I just started thinking, well, gosh, no, what if we used that kids chanting Trick or Treat and kind of set the meter, the timing of it a little off and the harmony of it a little skewed, and make it. And in my mind, I'm thinking, like, how will I make it so that it's obvious but not super and I'm not right on the nose? And I do my own little research, like, is this, did someone copyright this? Can I do this? And I just played this little thing on the piano, shipped it off to him, and he was just floored. Like, all of a sudden, here's this anthology, and now we have this idea that's going to be the connective tissue to the whole thing. And that really got him super excited. And from then on, it was just great working, you know, through all of it. And to answer your question, Ryan, that opening, that actually sort of all fell together probably within the last week, because they were, you know, the titles are the last thing. Yeah. All that stuff comes together, and we're days away from scoring, and the opening is a little bit different. Then you see this, and you're like, oh my gosh, we have to change it. We're not there yet. And that's sort of in the homage sense, that's the homage to Bernard Herrmann right there. I mean, there's no hiding it.
How did Mike find you? I mean, was he familiar with your work? Because you just said you'd never met him until, like...
Yeah, so he saw Monster House and said, you know, that he just loved the music and wanted to reach out to me. So he did. And he reached out to me, and we had a meeting, and, you know, had to go through the whole meeting with the studio and stuff, and they signed off, and we went from there.
Mm-hmm. And what was it like working with him on Krampus, having survived the Trick or Treat experience? Because I'm sure even as a composer, you were probably disappointed with the way the film was treated as well, I would imagine.
Well, of course. I mean, there are financial reasons, because as a composer, I would be more successful from a residual standpoint had they put it in theaters with all their contracts that go out to all the HBOs or Sci-Fis or whoever they have their deals with. So that didn't happen. So that's a major kind of knockoff, because I put actually every penny of the fee into the score, mm-hmm. every penny. So I made nothing for residuals. And then that didn't happen. So that was kind of a setback. But we worked together until Krampus came out. We did a lot of stuff together. And Fearnet did a 24-hour thing. Yeah. And we would do we did these spots for them.
Well, those are yours as well. That's great.
Yeah. There are a couple that had, they might have had like a song or something in there.
Sure, yeah.
But most of it was and then getting some kids and just doing all kinds of creepy things. And yeah. And then, we've worked together on development stuff all the way through. And then when Krampus, I can remember where I was when he sent me the script for Krampus and told me about it. First, before he sent me the script, he told me what he was doing. I'm a sports fan. I was at Angel Stadium at the time going into the game, and I'm kind of late for the game. He's telling me about it. I'm not going to the game. And he's telling me about this story. This is incredible. Like, can't wait to see the script. And then he sent me the script, and it was amazing.
Now, does he, maybe it's too early to tell in the process, but are you on board for Godzilla?
I'm not, and I know there are a lot of moving parts in that.
So. Of course, yeah. No, I had to ask, because that obviously hasn't been discussed yet in the press or anything like that. So
yeah, it's a sequel and a tentpole and tons
of
moving
course.
Parts.
There's a lot of like you said, there's a lot of people weighing in.
Yeah,
a lot of moving parts. Kevin, can you talk a little bit about the fact that both Trick or Treat and Krampus are both picture discs, and how difficult it is to put these things out? They're beautiful. They're absolutely beautiful, and mount them on the wall worthy. I mean, like I love the Trick or Treat picture disc, but every time I pull Krampus out, I'm like, oh, there's like these great. It's a nice testament to the design of the elves and the other creatures that are on it.
I mean, like those two movies, like Trick or Treat and Krampus, are just like so, like, it's eye candy.
Yeah.
It's visually pleasing. I know that Michael's vision is like, it's very strong and it's very intelligent and he's very educated. He's just killer. And I remember, like, when we were a little backstory, like last time that I was actually here, it's been a while since I've actually come out to LA. I lied to you earlier. It's not once or twice a year. It's been like 4 years since I've been here. Shit. It just hit me. But I was having a meeting with Michael, and like, this is before Krampus was even announced. And I was asking him, like, what are you working on? And, we were having breakfast or something. And like, he's like, yeah, well, I've got a new movie and it's going to be a Christmas movie. And I'm all like, what? So, like, okay, you're just going to do holiday movies? And he's like, no way. He's like, I can't really talk about it. And I'm like, come on, dude, just tell me. And he's like, do you know what Krampus is? And I was like, oh, shit. I was like, we got to do the soundtrack. And he's like, okay. But I know what, you know, the ancient folklore behind Krampus is. And, you know, like, it was just exciting. And, like, I just started right then and there, like, at that meeting, we started thinking about, like, the possibilities for, like, packaging. Like, what would it, you know, what would it entail? Like, could we do a pitcher disc? Like, there was nothing at that point. I mean, this was like 4 years ago. You know, so there was no, maybe he couldn't talk about it yet, but like there was no sort of like characters in my mind of like how we could like make the packaging killer. But at some point, like the studio provided us with, provided Waxwork with like something like 36,000 images.
Oh my goodness.
And they're all like high quality, like this like high res, like professionally shot photos of like all of the costumes, all of like the puppets, all of the characters and stuff. And I was like, whoa, like all the actors and everything. So we had like, I think more so than any other film that we've ever released a soundtrack for, we've had, with Krampus, like we had like just a plethora of shit to work with. It was just incredible, like sorting through almost 40,000 photos. So like we sent that off to like Justin Erickson from Phantom City Creative. And like, he's just this kind of like chameleon. He can like, he can do anything with regard to like creating artwork. I mean, he's just, he just did our Exorcist release, and like he did Krampus, obviously. So anyway, like basically, like we sent all that stuff to him, and like he just created this awesome like this artwork. But that wasn't enough, and like that's kind of like the Waxwork way, is that like it's never enough. Like we have to like, let's make picture discs, or like let's make a blood-filled record, you know. And so we decided like with the Dark Elves, like those Dark Elves, like we, and there's so many of them. I think there was like 9 or 10 of them. Mm-hmm. We had to like pick like 4 because it's a double LP and like just 4 sides. So like we pick like 4 of like the ones that we thought were like the best, and we just made these awesome picture discs. We did it for Trick or Treat as well because there were so many round. Actually, that was actually Michael Dougherty's like idea. He's like, let's do picture discs for Trick or Treat. Back when we were like just kind of like working on it. Because he's like, yeah, like one side can be like Sam's sucker, and then like the other side can be like the sucker bitten.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, yeah. And then like, you know, Sam's head is like round. So like we can do like, you know, one side with his mask and one side unmasked. There's just so much there. Like he just has like all of the, like, these great ideas and like this cool imagery that we were working with. That it was just kind of like just, it was a no brainer to like do picture discs.
Well, what I love, you talk about it's never enough. I love the attention to detail. And if I recall, it was delayed because you weren't satisfied with the packaging, which was Goosebumps. Package, which had the raised lettering, just like the books
did. That's what it was. Like, you know? That embossing that Goosebumps has on the cover, like we wanted to like basically create an LP that emulated, or that was basically just having like the book from the 90s, like, you know, one of the books. We wanted to have like a physical representation of that as like an LP. And that was way harder than it sounds. I mean, like, it's just, it's a pain. You'd think, oh, just emboss it. It's going to be easy. Just like have it embossed.
Yeah.
No, dude, it was a lot of trial and error getting that one going. Yeah. But it came out, you know, we made it happen. It took like 6 months to figure out how to like emboss it right. But like it worked out.
Yeah.
And I got to tell you, look, I'm one of these guys, Ryan, too, where we maybe are a little compulsive about our collecting, and we buy a lot of stuff. I buy a lot of records. And so sometimes, because at the volume that you guys are all putting this out, you and the other labels, you kind of get a little like, oh my God, I'm spending so much money on records. But I have to admit, and I'm not just saying this because you hear the quality Waxworks and the fact that you delay stuff and really get it right, like there is zero regret the second it's in my hand. And a perfect example is like when you did The Thing, for example. Okay?
Yeah, that was crazy.
Now, I've been wanting an original issue of The Thing forever. It's one of those records that I just never got. And it's, you know, it goes anywhere from like 70 to a couple, you know, $100 or whatever. And so, of course, you announce it. And then there's the deluxe version. And the deluxe version is $70, which is exactly how much I could get an original issue. And of course, compulsively, I'm like, I got to do it. I got to get the deluxe. So I get the deluxe and I'm like, I can't believe I just spent $70 on a record. And you know what? The second I got it and that thing cracked open, I was like, zero regrets. You know, I did like,
wait,
I did like
my creative.
It's no,
it's like the slipcase for it opens up like ice, like the ice is cracked.
Yeah.
Like
and in fact, I did like
inside is the record.
I did like the perfect Instagram video of like the theme just as it starts and I started moving the thing open, like the cracking. But again, it's like, you know, everybody's is very competitive now, but those are the details and the things that stand out is like when you physically hold it in your hand, it's as cool as it is. You're just like, you know what? I don't care. It's awesome. And I own it forever. And again, it's part of why we all love The Thing. So it's you know what? I need that in my collection.
Right. Yeah. I mean, like it would, you know, something like The Thing or like Creepshow or whatever, like those are like, you know, you could see them as like cash grabs. Like, you know, like we never release anything because like it's, oh, that's that's going to sell like thousands of copies. Like, we release it because like we're actual like true fans of it.
Like the Shockwave soundtrack?
Yeah, exactly. Like the Shockwave or like, you know, Chopping Mall or something. And like, yeah, like, oh shit. You know, like when we put out Shockwave, it's funny that you mentioned that there was like all of like this, I mean, when is it not shitty? But like all of like this crazy Nazi stuff was happening and like these idiots were coming out and like, you know, starting static. But like I was like, dude, and we're about to release a record with like a big SS zombie on the cover. I'm like, oh my god, like we need to not, maybe we shouldn't do this. And it's like everyone's like, no, do it. It's like it's a dead Nazi. It's great. And I'm like, all right. But or anyway, like
Florida Nazi.
Yeah,
it's fine. Florida. Yeah.
So yeah, like I was, even at that time, like when we were advertising it, I was like hashtagging Nazis suck and like Nazis are bad. You know? Like, just, but yeah, we do these things because like we're actual fans of doing them, and like it's nothing's a cash grab. So you know, with regards to like the Thing Deluxe version and like you know, the Blood-Filled record for Friday
the 13th. Warriors was really
the
impressive.
Warriors Deluxe yeah edition was crazy with like the back patches and the booklet, yeah. and all of those photos from the booklet like had never been seen before, like those we sourced from like the Paramount archive. It's like photos of like the Warriors like walking around in the daytime, like, yeah, that you've never seen before. It's really crazy. We feel as if like what we charge for that stuff, like the deluxe version of the Thing, for example, being $70, it's worth it. You know, what we put into it, it's very expensive to make these records, like the licensing. That's something that like we kind of like hear from a fair amount. Most people understand, like, and by most, I mean like the majority, the vast majority of our customers get it. Like they understand that, like, this shit is not easy to put out. And if it were, everyone would be doing it. So it's expensive, you know, like the licensing and remastering it from the original masters, because that's something that we do. Like, we don't have to do that. You know, like, the studio usually provides you with, like, waves, like, you know, like, digital files. And, like, or here's, like, a CD, or, like, here's, like, you know, we're just going to WeTransfer you this stuff. And I'm like, do you have the masters? Do you have, like, the actual 1973 masters of The Exorcist sitting somewhere? And they're like, yeah, like, we have to source them from, like, our compound that we keep in Kansas or whatever, you know? And that's expensive, like, being able to transfer those tapes and all this stuff. But, like, we feel... this is going to sound super like corny, but like we want to be like the Criterion of like soundtracks.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Even like paying something like Shockwaves the respect that it's due, you know, like getting the masters from like Shockwaves or Chud.
I can confirm members of Shockwaves have listened to the Shockwaves.
Oh, yeah. They have. Track together.
Yeah, that's true. We're excited. We need a good giveaway of that one day from us, you know.
Yeah. And I like giving Chud the respect it's
yes.
due.
Yes.
Well, the funny thing is you bring up Chud, you bring up Shockwaves, and then I just think, because honestly, Kev, on my little like quadrant of record shelf, I have the good old IKEA. You have this too.
Yeah,
Rob.
I got like seven of them.
The now. IKEA quadrant shelf.
The which, well, which, now it's like the Calyx or whatever.
But yeah, yeah, yeah. Look, yeah. I know the which is great. I mean, like, you have taken up one block, and
that's
I
it?
Always.
You need to get more variants, dude.
Well, I like looking at it and I go, oh my God, that's right. Chud. You did Chud. Black Christmas.
Yeah,
Black Christmas, which is one. The, let's admit it, it's the oddest thing to throw on.
Yeah.
Because it's a lot. It's a lot of just.
There's a lot of bad.
Ambient, and it's a lot of ambient stuff, a lot of music stuff, a little bit of eerie Christmas stuff, and then
to ask about Black Christmas really quick though, because I'm sure, and this might be like an obvious, like you're gonna be like, duh, what? but when it came out, I remember Tony Giles on the Damn Fine Cast played some of it, mm-hmm. and the kind of the observation we got, because what's weird about Black Christmas is that score is a little. Off, mm-hmm. right?
Sure.
Like it's like Christmas themes, like these famous Christmas themes you hear, yeah. but it feels a little off. And they were hypothesized, like, is this soundtrack Christmas from the perspective of the killer? Like, because obviously yes. it's like the way he hears Christmas themes is a little off and stuff.
Ah.
And so now I listen to that and I feel like I'm the killer from Black Christmas when I put on that record, because it is a little off.
Yeah,
it's really it's actually like. It's scary. It's legitimately scary. Like, listening to that by yourself in the dark is scary. Or, like, The Exorcist, for example, like, right before coming out here, literally the night before coming out here, like, we received our copies of The Exorcist in-house at Waxwork. And it's scary listening to that stuff by yourself. You know, like, to this day, I'm not afraid to say that. I have no shame in my game. But, Yeah, like Black Christmas is like, it's got a lot of like sound design. Like that release is like,
But I'm glad I have it because, you know, I mean,
it's
like,
not melodic at all. It's fucked up. It's, it's
really just put it on in the background. And if you have a guest over, they're going to be like, what the shit?
Yeah.
Is
and then like the language on it is like really like some things that you would never want to play with somebody around. Like,
well, the same goes for Shockwaves. I mean, the Shockwaves I don't necessarily toss on when the kid's around.
Right, yeah. There's a bunch of like Nazi
shit. Nazi chanting in there.
But it makes me like with that Black Christmas thing, I've known the movie most of my life. Mm-hmm. I'd never thought of the music that way until I listened to the soundtrack separately, you know, so that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, once you hear it, like, and Carl Zitterer, it's funny because, like, he actually did the soundtrack to A Christmas Story as well.
That's amazing.
The same guy that did Black Christmas did the soundtrack to A Christmas Story, which, and Porky's, by the way.
Makes sense.
Talking with him about it, like, at that time, like, and it makes sense why he did Black Christmas the way he did, because he was, like, heavily influenced by, like, films like Quiet On and, like, the soundtrack to Quiet On, which is just, like, frightful. It's scary. It's really fucked up. Lots of sound design and, like, Texas Chainsaw. It's just, like, it's less musical and, like, more, like, let's see what this metal thing sounds like with this other metal thing hitting it and, like, running it through a distortion pedal or something, which is really cool. It's, like, a really abstract, avant-garde way of, like, approaching music that I really love. So yeah, like that's Black. I mean, Black Christmas wasn't supposed to come out ever commercially. The tapes were thought the actual master tapes were thought to have been like lost for like 40 years. But then like Carl found them and he's like, Kevin, I found the tapes. And I'm like, you're kidding me! Like this is amazing! Holy shit! So like yeah, like doing Black Christmas was like a big win for us.
And great packaging.
Man. The packaging. I mean, like, the
Gary artwork. Yeah, Gary, which who you use quite a bit. And shout out to the house release, which is now my new favorite.
Wow.
It's so fun. It's so fun. It's such a weird score. And it sounds like there's like a rubber ducky in it every once in a while.
Yeah.
Where it's like squeaky, squeaky. And I'm like, what the? It's good. It's good stuff. It's, it just suits the tone of the film itself.
Yeah. It's campy.
Yeah. I was going to say for Doug, you're doing Babysitter. You've done the Babysitter. Are we going to see a Babysitter record release, maybe?
Trying to make that happen. I don't know how easy that is.
Yeah. I know. Ryan's asking hard questions and putting these guys on the spot.
Well, no, we're trying to push, push the buttons. It's Netflix.
Well, I was going to say, who owns it? Because I know it started one place but ended somewhere else. So is it Netflix that has to have the final say?
Yeah, and I think it just becomes – almost, I hope I don't say the wrong thing, but just they have so many things going on that this is a procedural thing.
Netflix? I've never heard of their...
Are they doing anything?
Are they busy these days?
They don't even put special features on their freaking physical releases, which pisses me off.
But they did have Stranger Things sweatpants in Target, which I now own. So let's give them some love
and
for
blankets.
That, guys.
And just to clarify, so... when it comes to licensing stuff, you're only licensing for vinyl, correct? Like, there's a difference if they if you wanted to put a CD, for example, of it. Like, because I always wondered that. Because, I bought the Trick or Treat CD when it came out at Dark Delicacies, where you were there.
Right.
But I always heard that, like, because people are like, why doesn't it come with a digital download or whatever?
Yeah. It's extra licensing. It's, like, basically, like, another license for, like, you know, digital or CD or whatever. Like, I would love to do it. And I'm well aware that, like, we could sell probably thousands more copies if we do like CDs and like you know, actually like stream this stuff. But I just really love vinyl. I for better or worse, I mean, like, I might be like shooting myself in the foot and like not making money off of like digital sales, but like I just like the format. It's like it's a harder way of doing things, but like it's really intimate, you know. I love it.
Well, Douglas did the theme for House of Waxworks, which is your comic book series.
Well, yeah.
Explain.
Okay, all right.
Let's get the scoop. What happened here?
So people throw this shit around where they say, like, you know, like, I couldn't have done it without him, blah, blah, blah. Like, most times when people say that, like, you could have done it. You know, like, you'd find a way to figure out whatever that thing is that you're trying to do without having to, like, say that nice thing about the other guy. But literally, like, House of Waxwork, the theme song, would not have happened without Douglas. Like, it would not have freaking happened in a minute. Like, no, I'm serious.
Not
I'm
true.
Not, no, dead serious. Like, the House of Waxwork theme was composed by myself and a close friend of mine named Rami Sharkey in New Orleans at Waxwork headquarters. And it was just kind of like this really, like, I mean, I'm not a, you know, a legit, like, composer. I can write a song, you know, but I know it sounds good. You know, I can't read music. I wish I could. I need to educate myself. I need to, like, come hang out with Douglas. but yeah, so, like, we wrote this song together, and, like, I ran it by, and it was, you know, basically everything was done in the box, like in the box, meaning like done in like Pro Tools or like Logic or whatever. There was some like, you know, physical instruments as well that we ran through. Like, you know, I have a, you know, a Mini Moog, and I have like an OB6 and like some synthesizers and like a, obviously a lot of guitars because like I come from that punk background. But like, you know, all of the strings were fake, quote unquote. I mean, like they're digital, like everything was done kind of like with keyboards. And I ran it by Douglas. I'm like, you know, we need to like, Susie actually, like who, you know, I keep like throwing Susie out there. Like she co-runs Waxwork, and like she, you know, without her, this shit wouldn't be happening either. So,
right.
You know, she was like, you need to run that by a composer that we work with, like somebody like working like right now that like can like tell you, is this like, is this good or not? Because like, it's going to be the theme song for like this new company that we're starting. So like, I was like, let's run it by Douglas. I mean, like he would know. And when we sent it to him, he's like, yeah, this is really good, but like, it would be so much better with an actual orchestra performing the strings. I was like, oh shit, how are we going to do that? He's like, it's you can do it. We'll figure it out. You know, we'll figure it out. So Douglas took the music and he actually, what's like the...
Orchestrated
it. Yeah, he orchestrated it. Yeah, I was trying to find it. See, I'm not a composer.
but you wrote all the parts. And yeah. It was just, the song is so great. And he was using a synth that was emulating the strings. And that, so the sort of the thought that's going through my head is like, oh, I don't want to say the wrong thing because maybe that's what is called for. You know, I don't want to say something that goes, no, no, no. What are you talking about? Synth strings are the what we want. But it sounded like if you were, you know, if that's what you were going for, what if we did real strings?
Yeah, and we wanted both. We wanted to have like this. We wanted an orchestra, but like obviously, like we didn't know, like, is this going to cost $1 million? Like, what do we do? So Douglas figured all of that out for us. But we also wanted like the kind of like segue into like this synth electronic element, which is like the second half of the song.
Right. Gets a little metal there too, which I love.
It gets crazy. Towards the end, it's like, yeah, there's like double bass and like there's all kinds of like, I mean, there's like chains and stuff and like there's all kinds of like crazy stuff happening in that song. But yeah, like, you know, Douglas really like helped us out with that. You know, I mean, I bet basically like I put Waxwork is kind of like this machine now that like, you know, it's running. We have like employees now and everything. And like, I backed out for like a month to like write that song with Rami and to actually like record it and everything and like work with Douglas on it. I just said like, you know, like Waxwork will be okay without me for a month. You know, I just kind of like backed away and like just dove in and like realized like, wow, like this is probably the hardest thing that I've ever like wrote and recorded. You know, obviously like punk songs are easier, right? But it was amazing being able to like work with like an orchestra for the first time and like just like, this is how you do it legitimately. You know, like this is how the pros do it, right? Anyway, so like hopefully there's more of that in the future on a grander scale, like a more professional way. I don't know.
But it's the approach to the song was total punk rock, and it seemed like you got to have people sawing at strings if it's going
to
have that.
There was an
edge.
Urgency to it. Yeah.
Yeah. It needed to have that sort of violent attack.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And I don't know if you plan it, but literally I remember talking about it on the show when the book finally arrived, and it's two stories. Yeah. Two stories. Somehow the musical cues that are for each story are like exactly the length it takes to read them. They're like, I don't know, 5-6 minutes or whatever. So it's like, as I listened to the first one, I made it through the first story and I was like, okay, flip the record. Yep. And then made it through the second story. I was like, this is like a cool experience. Like,
that's,
you know,
really
actually
cool.
Getting
that's
it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And when does two hit?
November. Yeah. Like, it's going to be November.
Were you inspired by the books that did that during the 80s? Because I had some books that, like, you would read it along with the accompanying record, and then, like, you would hear,
like
little...
Fox and the Hound.
Yeah, that was Disney. Actually one that I had. And I had a Scary Stories one that I remember really vividly.
Oh,
had
Georgie the Ghost?
Yeah, yeah, I had a couple of them. And I had one that I remember, it was just called Scary Stories. I did have Georgie the Ghost, but it had a girl in a red nightgown on the front, and she was, like, you could see her through a window. But it had a booklet along with it, and you would hear these like chimes when it wanted you to like turn a page and things like that.
Yeah, we were obviously inspired by like all of like the EC and creepy like comics, like the horror stuff, like that was coming out, like Tales from the Crypt and like Vault of Horror and stuff. But not at any point, because we knew that it would be so easy just to like, because I have a lot of those like old sets from like the 80s of like, you know, like the box set of all the Tales from the Crypt comics. We made it a point, like, don't crack those open. Like, don't look at those. We don't want to have any sort of point of reference, because like then it's going to be derivative of something that's been done before a million times. We wanted House of Waxwork Because, I mean, like, you know, you think horror anthology comic, how many times has that been done, right? So it was really, really important. And this is why it took 2 years to make happen, you know, like adding the musical element and making sure that it wasn't anything that, like, you could pick up and be all like, oh, yeah, this is just like Vault of Horror or whatever, or like Haunt of Fear. Like, it needed to be its own brutally original thing and not derivative of anything that's been done ever. So, like, I think we accomplished that. I remember the first time, like, experiencing it for the first time, reading it and listening to the record. Mm-hmm. And I was like, holy shit. Like, it was really, it was crazy. It was, like, this overwhelming sense of, like, accomplishment. Because it was a lot of work. I mean, literally 2 years went into it. Like, lots of legal stuff and, like, you know, like, lots of friendships broken. Like, it was crazy. It was an uphill battle, but we made it happen. It was awesome.
And is the director, because I remember when I brought it in, Becca's like, he looks like David Lynch.
Everyone thinks that he looks like David Lynch. It's really just the hair, the awesome yes. hair.
Yeah. Well, David Lynch does have awesome hair.
Yeah, and yeah. he can be whoever you want him to be.
Right.
You know, okay. If the director, we really want him to be kind of like this, like, William Friedkin type of character, mm-hmm. just with the way that he presents himself. And he's just like, he's cooler than cool. He invented cool. We don't know how old he is. But yeah, like, the director is kind of like our crypt keeper. Mm-hmm. And he looks a little bit like David Lynch.
Yeah.
He's got that thing.
I guess, you know, obviously we'll wrap it up a little bit. But I'm curious, how far ahead are you when it comes to your releases? Because obviously the comics probably take a really long time, as you just said. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious, like, how often you'll plan on doing that. But even with, you know, Exorcist was a 4-year journey.
Yeah, yeah.
So how many titles are you working on right now?
Oh, wow. Like, at any given time, like, we're concurrently working on, like, 20 titles. Like,
wow.
Right. I mean, I looked at, like, the release schedule for 2018, and it's, like, it's crazy. It's, like, something like 22 releases. And I'm all, like, that's not going to happen. Like, there's no way we can get that out without flooding the market or, like, just expecting people to buy a record, like, every couple of weeks. It's just, it would be shitty. It's great that we have these titles. It's a good problem to have, right? But, like, we're at this point now where we're like, you know, back in the day, like, when we were working on, like, Rosemary's Baby, we were just working on Rosemary's Baby, and it was, like, really, it was kind of nice. It was like, people, like, always say, like, oh, it's harder in the beginning. I'm like, no, dude, it was easy in the beginning. It was nice. Like, we were just, like, working on Day of the Dead. Okay, we did it. We released it. Now we're doing Creepshow, you know? But now it's all, like, we're working on this, we're working on that. We're doing, like, the 1990 It miniseries, like, yeah, we're doing that.
Are you really? Yeah, oh my god, I was actually gonna tweet, like, wow. I wish somebody would put out the original music because obviously everybody's been It crazy,
yeah.
And I still love the original.
Yeah,
I love
the last time I revisited it. I was like, this music's really great,
yeah.
Wow, so is that an exclusive? Did you ever,
yeah, I did. I dropped that. Yeah.
Cruising
just dropped
in 1990 It.
Nice.
Look at that. Just dropped.
That's
on
all
the
you're
show.
Getting.
Do you have any, like, other Exorcist titles that no one's put out yet that, because they're really difficult to get and you're just your golden dream kind of title you're chasing?
Yeah, but I can't talk about it.
Because it's actually possible.
Yeah, because it's actually possible. Yeah.
Oh, wow, wow. And what about more, like, we were joking before when we were talking about Exorcist, the Schifrin score, like, Coil, the Hellraiser score to Coil.
Yeah, doing a label
unreleased, like,
unreleased
rarities.
Scores. Yeah,
we actually talked about doing, like, a part two thing, like, just part twos of everything. Like, we did Evil Dead 2. Let's do, like, Darkman 2. Just
Child's Play 2.
Child's Play 2. Like, Fright Night 2.
Yeah, forget about the originals. Like,
yeah,
fuck them. Like,
do
we're just gonna, let's just do a whole series of, like, just twos, like Ninja Turtles 2. Like, just let's get crazy with
it. Yeah, I'm into that.
But that might happen. I don't know. Like, I don't know. We're campy enough. I don't want to, like, kind of, like, become a parody of ourselves.
And Doug, what do you have in the pipeline?
I just finished. I have a couple, you know, feelers out there on a couple things, but I just finished up doing a silent score for a Buster Keaton film called The General.
Oh wow!
One of the best movies ever made.
Yeah, it was one of those live to silent score commissions by the Dallas Chamber Symphony, and it was a pretty short thing. We just did the concert last Tuesday. A lot of fun.
But they recorded it too? Like, would they put it?
No, so okay, it's just a live concert they play to picture.
Yeah, that's cool.
And no click track, nothing.
Yeah,
so wow. you put the tempos down, and they have a couple days to rehearse it and play it through, and the conductor out there is brilliant, Richard McKay, and the Dallas Chamber Symphony really did
that's
a great
cool
job. It was, yeah, a lot of fun.
That's got to be a thrill because it's like a live, it's literally performing live show.
Yeah, yeah. And and things move, like, kind of close to the sink and back and forth. And Yeah, it's a lot of fun. But other than that, yeah, just have like some feelers out on a couple things.
Nice. Okay.
Very cool. Wow. Well, thank you guys so much for coming down.
Yeah, yes, dude. Talking and
celebrating our Halloween episode with us.
Yeah. And we didn't mention the Don't Look Now score, so you may got to check that out because I think that's one of the most beautiful scores ever. Peter DiNaggio, it's like one of my favorites. Yeah. The artwork's wild, too.
Oh, yeah.
Like super crazy.
That was a crazy one to work on. Yeah. Like, we got Jessica Siemens to do the artwork, and she's just amazing. Like, she's everything is like analog, you know, she works with watercolors only, and like, it's just, yeah.
It seems to sum it up. There's something about that movie. I love it. It's almost like the reflection in the
that
water.
Is a great movie. I mean,
yeah, that's one of the best movies. I think.
It is. It's really great.
Yeah.
Well, actually, before we wrap, because you just reminded me, like, obviously, you get to talk to a lot of these filmmakers when it comes to their scores and stuff. And I think I read maybe an interview or something about, you know, talking to Martin Scorsese about doing like Taxi Driver. So
yeah, that was crazy.
So what's it like? What did he call you? And,
yeah,
like, or you called him? Or?
So it's there was a time when like. I would get like a call from like no caller ID would show up on my phone or like unknown or whatever. And I wouldn't answer them because I was like, oh, who's this like creditor or something?
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
But now I answer all of those calls because like, it's usually like William Friedkin or like, you know, Scorsese.
It's one of the movie brats, you know, it could be Spielberg, De Palma, whatever.
It's like, and it's funny. Like you answer and they're like, okay, Martin Scorsese would like to speak with you. We're going to connect you. And I'm like, wait, what's going on? Hold on. Time out. And you have like no time. And you're like, oh shit. Like, hey, there's Marty. And I'm like, oh, hey, hold on. What's going on? And you're trying to like find composure and like, you know, but I mean, that was really cool. You know, like, being professional about it. Like, it was really great being able to like work with him and like, he was excited. He was really, really excited to like.
That's his natural state, though.
Yeah, yeah.
I've never seen him not animated.
Super jovial, like awesome guy, and like super nice. Like, that was awesome. And like, you know, we sent him some records, and like, he really thought it was awesome. And like, we actually, when you know, we usually send like a box of records off to like the composer and the director if like they're still kicking. And I wasn't even expecting it, but like. Martin Scorsese like sent me one copy back autographed and he's like, thanks Kevin for everything. I was like, whoa.
Wow,
like,
that's pretty cool.
I wasn't expecting that. That's awesome. Yeah, it was cool.
And I just want to throw a plug in for your subscription, the Waxwork subscription service, which I think is fantastic. Is it coming back for another year, do you think? Or
we're doing it again in 2018.
That's great. Yeah, no, I think it's great. And for you listeners out there, you just subscribe and then you get subscriber exclusive records.
Yeah. Is it 5 a year roughly? Or?
Yeah, it's 5 records a year. You know, everything's like exclusive, color wise, you know, like these records are still released like to the public, but subscribers get like a special variant as well as like other like incentives, like such as like a discount that they can use on anything that we sell throughout the year.
Yeah.
Screen printed posters, t-shirts, enamel pins, just a bunch of stuff. It's worth
cool.
it.
And I'm looking forward to the Babadook, I think, which wraps up the subscription year, right? I just recently rewatched Babadook and I paid specific attention to the score and it got me really excited for your release. So can't
wait.
Thank
you. Yeah, it's gonna be cool.
Guys, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
And happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween.